Hey, everybody. Just a quick note before this episode gets started proper. I know that this is being updated a couple of weeks after the fact, after these have long gone up on the site, but we made a grievous error in which one of our listener lists somehow slipped through the cracks and it did not end up getting read during the main show, and I felt really bad, and I want to correct that, especially given that this person is a very important member of our community. So I wanted to go ahead and correct that issue now by reading their list before this episode gets starts. This list comes in from our good pal, Beepner. At number 3, he has Planetarian HD, and he says, I want to say something about what it means to be human in an inhumane world, or about attributing humanity to non-human things, but my brain is going, ah, with the image of the crying battler emoji. Yeah, that makes sense. those sad robot girl games get you every time. Number 2, there's a banger that everybody loves. Soxcast approved, even if John hasn't played it yet. 13 Sentinels, Aegis Rim. This is a beefy narrative in the form of a hybrid visual novel and a point-and-click adventure that weaves parallel action and alternate timelines. I can take or leave the strategy sim part of it, but it serves to break up the drama. I wish it were better paced throughout the main game. The game has all the references. Yeah, this game really does. You are eating good if you were playing 13 Sentinels Aegis Rim and you have a hefty dose of 80s anime in your brain. And game of the year goes to Metroid Dread. Dread showed me that this kind of game can be fun again. There's always a sense of discovery and accomplishment and unlocking a new area. The backtracking and getting lost can be a bit much at times, but a lesser game would either tell you what to do or not give you enough incentive to keep pushing on. Ravenbeak and the Blowjob Brothers can chew phase on. Those fights are pretty rough, but some of the most satisfying bits of action gaming I've had in recent years. So thank you so much, Beepner, for the list, and we are so, so sorry that your list slipped through the cracks, and I hope that us going back and putting this in before the episode proper gets started can be apology enough. And with that, on with the show. Once again, back to save the universe, and I've exercised a little bit of restraint there in referencing Airbag by Radiohead because I'm pretty damn sure I've opened this show with that song's chorus before. But we are back for day 2 of the Soxcast Game of the Year Spectacular for 2024. We hope you're all nice and rested up from the absolute mammoth of a show that was yesterday's, because we're not. No, we're just charging through.
I've got blueberries and sake now.
We're charging through like the heroes that we are. I am chock full of cocktail shrimp and Oreos.
I had a thing of canned soup.
Trying to think of like sake. What, like maybe the saddest dinner anybody's had. I just ate a ring of cocktail shrimp and had like 4 Oreos.
So see how... Polly, anytime somebody has cocktail shrimp, that's a win.
I think so. I'm a big fan of cocktail shrimp. I remember a few days ago, people telling me, you know what, you're pretty real for just buying the cocktail shrimp ring and eating it yourself.
Fuck yeah.
It's like, you know what, yeah, I'm going to live in the lap of luxury, motherfucker. You try and stop me. But I am, of course, joined once again by my absolutely going to be dead by the end of this co-hosts. To my immediate virtual right, he's worked too hard for his illusions just to throw them all away. It's Rhett!
Hello.
That is a double entendre that I'm very proud of for coming off the top of my head right now, because at both refers to a song lyric, and Koikatsu cards are called illusion cards.
Oh, wow.
Brilliant.
Look at me go. I'm still in tip-top shape. Best podcast host doing it. Joe Rogan, suck my asshole. To my immediate virtual left, coming January 2025 to a theater near you, it's John Thayer.
Hi.
That's hey, me. John, you're ready for day number two.
Really, it's really a January release, huh?
It really is.
Not great.
No, it's not usually when you want to be in theaters.
No.
But that's the best we could do. You're ready for day two. Rhett's ready for day two.
Again, I can't emphasize this enough. We figured out that we can just microwave sake and then have hot sake at home.
Yeah. Hot sake is pretty good. I'm refraining from alcohol while doing the 4-hour podcast, though.
Yeah, it's not great for the throat.
It's probably not. Yeah, like I was going to say, like I the throat thing is not going to, you're not going to like this in a bit, I don't think.
Oh my God, I've been standing this entire time. I think I need to lower the desk.
Way to the world. Time to change. Time to change. But you know who else is ready for day two of the Soxcast End of the Year Spectacular? It's our good pal, Angry Ed! Angry Ed, he's going to get things started for us on day two. He has provided us, thankfully, with a listener list that is in audio format. And I'm going to press play on that sumbitch in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hello there, everybody. It's Angry Ed. Another end of the year is upon us, and this one could have been a lot better. But let's talk games. Let's talk three games.
Yep. Ooh. We got production values.
Helldivers 2 for the PC and PS5. Despite how awful everything is and will get, Helldivers 2 still remains a fun game with enough satire to make Mark Twain claim it's too much. Make no mistake, you are definitely not the heroes the in-game propaganda claims you are. But underneath all that satire of a hyper-capitalist, galaxy-conquering super-Earth is a fun team-based extraction shooter full of explosions, ragdolls, explosions, robots, explosions, giant bugs, explosions, incredible scenery, explosions, humor, and did I mention the explosions? Even when things aren't working well, the game continues to chug along and provide hours of entertainment, despite Sony's best attempts to ruin the experience for everyone. I hope this game will continue to be a success going forward, because I could really use some dark chuckles and a tight gameplay loop in one convenient package.
Hans, are we the baddies?
Abiotic Factor for the PC. Along with Voices of the Void, this game forms the cornerstone of the emerging genre I like to call the Half-Like, a game inspired by Half-Life and its Source Engine successors, where you play a bunch of scientists deep in an Australian science facility that seems like a cross between Black Mesa and the SCP Foundation. Something has gone terribly wrong, of course, and now you and your friends must find a way to escape to the surface, all while battling escape test subjects, interdimensional horrors, and a crazy religious cult that broke a bunch of things because they didn't understand what they were dealing with. A survival game with a unique twist, the game has you jumping across multiple dimensions to find equipment and piece together tools that will help you progress through the damaged facility in an effort to finally be free. Very fun game, especially with friends, and while still in development, the updates come frequently enough that it's great to be able to come back after a couple months to experience the changes. Project Silverfish for the PC. Technically, this one isn't even out yet, it's just a playable demo on Steam, but it's amazing. Project Silverfish is a stalker-ish FPS from the creator of Adaka, speaking of Half-Likes, set in a post-human world now inhabited by anthropomorphic lizard people. You play one of the 6 heavily in-debt character types, or a randomly generated character, deposited into a zone full of trigger-happy militants, bizarre mutants, crazy robots that spit canned film strip lines at you, and anomalous phenomena. From there, you proceed to take jobs for various factions, fight others, collect artifacts to boost your stats, or sell for cash, and of course, just try to survive an incredibly hostile world. The demo is well polished, offering excellent control and gunplay, as well as enough variety to play it over and over again. I've put nearly 48 hours into it, which really reminds me of game demos of the past that provide a slice of the full game, but with enough going on to keep it coming back. I can't wait for the full release. And that's gonna do it for me. I hope to see you all same time next year. Stay safe, stay hydrated, be excellent to one another.
Thank you, Ed. think it's like, what, two like demos that have made that have topped somebody's game of the year list? What are what are they putting in demos these days? These demos, like, you know, just give really good oral sex or something, or I mean,
I remember being like that with the Just Cause 2 demo.
The Just Cause 2 demo. I remember you hacking that shit for infinite time, and you literally, like, it was literally the only game you played for, like, a month until the game actually came out. Yeah.
Yeah. I may have liked the demo more than the game.
Yeah, I heard that a lot, actually, when it came out. Having finished the Just Cause 2, yeah, it's okay. It was fun, but it's okay. Anyway, that's literally not what we're here to talk about at all.
Yeah.
We have another listener list, right? I can't believe it.
Hey. This comes in from Venner Orion.
There's a name.
Hey, Venner.
Number one, Harvestella. I got a recommendation from this from the last place I'd expect and wound up playing it, and once I got into it, really enjoyed it. This feels like the closest thing to a sequel to Rune Harvest Frontier that I'm ever going to get, but it's obviously its own thing. The story and even side stories were all pretty interesting, and the game had a nice balance of combat and farming. I still can't get over how interesting the plot of the game was and struck a nice balance between being post-apocalyptic and being upbeat at the same time. Number two, Vampire Survivors. Yeah. I finally played this and I'm kind of stunned at how good this game is, along with how much effort was put into it, especially with the most recent DLC for it. Me and my friend co-opted through the Castlevania stuff, and it was genuinely one of the most fun games I played all year. The Castlevania DLC sounds insane.
Yeah, it, like, they've really done the work for this game. Like, I could not be happier that Vampire Survivors is still a game I'm hearing about.
Yeah.
It's really dope.
And number three, Ys X Nordics.
Hey!
I started out liking this game a lot. Then the chase with the giant whale happened, and I fucking knew I loved this game. This might be my favorite Ys game, and definitely my favorite of the newer ones. I also love Karja. She might be my favorite female protagonist in a video game in a long while, and the story was pretty good, and it didn't drag out or overstay its welcome. Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year, yo.
Solid list, damn!
And didn't complain about the ship combat.
Did not. Yeah, I was waiting for the ship combat blur part of the blur.
I think we're at five Falcom mentions. Wow. And one conspicuous absence. I'm curious if that'll be rectified.
I'm really kind of the fact that I have not heard it yet. I'm shocked. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
We'll see.
Well, I suppose it's time for me to get us started for the day.
Let's do it.
Mm.
So I think you all are probably have been sitting here this whole time, especially through yesterday's, and you were just like, there's one glaring thing missing from Polly's list. Where are the visual novels at?
True.
True.
What the hell? Where'd those go? Well, I'll tell you what. I saved it all up, and I got a real good one for you. How do y'all feel about Seabed?
Oh, fuck yeah.
Oh, jeez.
So up front, I'm gonna dispel and dispute the way that this game is marketed and presented on the various storefronts that it appears, because I think the expectations that it creates about being like a sprawling mystery about a missing person really does set people up with the wrong idea. like this is not a missing person story. This game literally tells you what happened 90 minutes in. And it's not hard to guess what it is. And that threw me off when I first started playing this game, because I was like, all right, I'm looking for clues. Like, you know, I'm in theory mode. Let's go. And then we're just doing cute stuff at the beach with our girlfriend and going on trips and like being sad around our apartment. Oh, I think I know where this is going. No, you're not going to need a notepad to jot down anything for theories or to understand what this game, like, this is a game where just, like, when it finally kind of, like, coils itself around you and everything that it's doing, you know, that's when
it, like, all snapped into focus, like, probably two-thirds in.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, and
that's
then started crying.
When the game becomes its most brilliant. So the core of the story is between Sachiko and Takako, two girls who have grown up together. The game's story spans a time from when they met in school to eventually becoming lovers and starting a business together and just experiencing this mm-hmm. lifetime of success in a very short amount of time. It is
mostly them as adults, which is also very nice.
Yes, it's a very adult story. Mm-hmm. It's very mature. It's lovely. It's warm. It's captivating. Both characters are just unbelievably well defined and fun. They are not like archetypes at all. They are just very cool, like people. And they work so well together. Their relationship is so warm and just loving, and they have so much fun with each other, and the chemistry is perfect. And then there's like Dr. Hibiki, who is also just a fantastic perspective and voice to everything that we're treated throughout, like when we get to experience things from her point of view. And she's like a front runner for like best character too. She's fantastic. I guess like my baseline self for this game is it's just like a great story with a lot of perspective changes that gradually mm-hmm. paint the canvas with the broad, beautiful strokes of lives lived. I don't think it's hard to understand what this game's doing at any point. And I also think that it's really hard to talk about the impact that it has without spoiling what you probably already know is going on.
But again, I'd probably leave it like unsaid, because I do feel like there's a potency to that moment where it's like, this is what this is about.
Yeah, like it is just a very grounded story. And it being so grounded is foundational to understanding some very intense things that it's dealing with. And like the very grounded and mundane way that it approaches its climax is one of the most affecting moments I've ever experienced in a story. I've never experienced something like that be presented the way this game handles it. And it is bar none like the most beautiful moment ever. It's so amazing. Seabed is awesome. It is just, it does have pacing issues, I think. I think that it does kind of spin its wheels a little, but it is an amazing.
Like fucking every VN.
Every VN ever.
So I remember bitching when somebody was, a friend was playing this game and complaining about the pacing. And I was like, every fucking VN in the universe has shitty pacing.
They probably like Umineko too, I bet. They do. I bet as a fucking Umineko fan complaining about pacing. Get out of here, Umineko.
No, you're welcome here, please.
You're welcome here, but
you're valid.
I'm still gonna have some thoughts, but Seabed is amazing. Like I think it's one of the more like once I was completely open to what it was doing, and there's like, oh, I had got myself in the right mindset. Oh, then it hits a whole different way, and I literally cruise through it in like 2 days. But yeah, gorgeous story, fantastic characters. I have never cried so hard at what they do with this ending. It's just, Christ, dude, it's so good.
I think it's like a completely it's an inverted House in Fata Morgana.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. Yeah, or it's just Fata Morgana takes like the most dramatic and kind of loud path to get there. Mm-hmm. And then Seabed takes the completely quiet, grounded path to get to the similar place.
Yeah. They go to the same place, but they get there. And I think that I just love this one so much more for the way that it does it. It's just that moment. That moment just hit me like a goddamn ton of bricks, to use an overused idiom. But it just, I was bowled over at how classy that was. And just how amazing that moment feels. And then when it contextualizes shit like the first lines of the story, I was like,
this is a real good one, y'all.
Yeah, this one's great. Like, this one's got all that Dojin energy, too. Mm-hmm. It recently got updated, so it includes all of the Switch stuff, too. Cool. There's some extra bonus content that was in the Switch version. It is all now in the PC version, and it's got a better engine that's less clunky now. So it,
nice.
That was another issue I had with this game, is that the engine was really clunky when I played it, but it got updated about a month ago with all the Switch content, as well as a new engine, and it just feels and plays really nice now. I gave it a first couple chapters another look the other night, just to kind of refresh my mind on this one a little bit. And
no, needs that jank. What's the engine? The engine that all those old games have.
Unscripted.
It needs that end script jank to feel legit.
Yeah. It definitely, like, that original version definitely had that on scripted or jank. Ooh. Good stuff.
I'd love to see it.
But yeah, Seabed's awesome. Great Yuri visual novel. You're in for a great time. Just kind of be prepared to kind of get cozy with it.
Yeah, trust it.
Just trust it. It's going to get you there. Even if you got to take like a break between chapters, just let it get you there.
It's a long book, but it's a good one.
Yeah,
it'll get you there.
It is a visual novel that reads like an actual novel. It feels more written like an actual novel and not a light novel, I guess, is kind of.
Yeah, it's like it's you're bundling up for like an 800-page Murakami book, basically.
Yeah. There you go. Best way I can put it.
Fucking better than any Murakami book I've read, though.
John!
I got a listener list for you.
I want a listener list.
From ePago.
Yeah, iPago. I saw that name, and I've never wanted to say their name out loud because I never wanted to get it wrong.
iPago. I'm gonna do a Japanese pronunciation. Ipego-san has a list for us. That's hello. I got my list. Number 3, Momodora Moonlit Farewell. Was that this year? Or
that
last
was
year?
This year. That was the new one.
Okay. A solid end to the Momodora trilogy. After Every End of the Moonlight took a lot of people by surprise, I was wondering what to expect more from Ardeen. Yeah, a lot of people were. Minoria, Momodora's spiritual successor, didn't really impress me, but once I saw the trailer for Moonlit Farewell, I knew this was going to be good. The right amount of difficulty, good boss fights, and a large world to explore makes this a great send-off to the franchise. It's also a great standalone title. Number 2, Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, second mention. Probably the most ambitious Yakuza Like a Dragon game ever. The story is full of melodrama galore as usual, but the side content is just even more bonkers. There's just way too many things to do, and I struggled to do everything until the post-game. The combat system has been refined from Yakuza 7 for better and worse. The plot suffers quite a bit before the finale, but the finale more than makes up for it with tons of fan service and an homage to what Kazuma Kiryu, a 21st century gaming icon. If you're a middle-aged adult gamer, this is the game for you. And number 3, Metaphor ReFantazio. This is what I wanted Final Fantasy to be in the 21st century, an epic turn-based RPG adventure, is all caps, on the power of fantasy to change lives for the better. I've been waiting for this game since it was first announced as Project ReFantasy. Metaphor is just a timely game, as it talks about the politics behind prejudice and discrimination in a very blunt manner. I love how every party member is of a different race to highlight the power of diversity. The game also has a very solid turn-based system and an amazing OST. Hello, Buddhist priests. Atlas never ceases to amaze me, and this was a better experience than Persona 5. That's it.
I like that ReFantazio has been as popular as it has been because it is turn-based, and I think that we've seen a shift from turn-based systems in big RPGs as of late, and like I'm really glad that they kind of stuck to doing what they do.
Good.
Kind of like an action element to it. Like you can kind of like whoop up on monsters a little bit before the fight, like in an action game sense, but you still do the turn-based thing unless you out-level them by a lot.
The thing is, don't forget, Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth is also a turn-based RPG.
It is, yeah! That's right!
Like a Dragon, those devs, they're just like...
They're having the most fun
because they're making a lot
they're
of games.
They're making a lot of damn games now, yeah.
They're like one of the few AAA studios that's like doing what AAA studios should be doing, which is reusing engines and assets and making a shit ton of games. Yep. Making more games than you can keep up with. That's the job of a AAA game studio. IndieCreates is doing it too. Just make more games than people can play.
Yeah, that's a solid plan. Make them all on the same engine.
Mm-hmm.
Save you some time.
People can pick and choose what they engage with. Like, that's how it used to be. Yeah. Now it's every studio makes one game every 5 years.
Mm-hmm. 5 years, more like 7 and 8 in some cases.
And if every person on the planet, and if every person on the planet Earth doesn't engage with it, well, guess what? That was a waste. You just wasted 10 years. Good job.
God. So yeah, Like a Dragon. I'm gonna play those someday. Yeah. All right, who's next?
I think Rhett.
Oh, it is me.
It's you.
Okay, so I said the bottom five games were not perfect. They all had some flaw. Right. Now we're in the perfect game category.
All right. You got some big shoes to fill, dog.
This is maybe the one that surprised me the most getting this far. It's The Legend of Nyuta, Boundless Tales.
Oh,
Boundless Trails, sorry.
Wow. Fuck yeah. Okay, hit me.
Because when I just looked back at this game, I didn't see any flaws. I just thought I had an excellent time with this start to finish.
Man, sometimes fuck, that's all it takes, man.
I'm gonna play this before Cold Steel.
And it just... It's like a very... It's a good throwback to, like, that certain era of Falcom being a little less pretentious, I guess, and just every game needing to be...
An epic.
Or a 4,200-hour epic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is, like... I think it was a Vita game, but it still has that like PS2, PSP energy.
Good. Like,
it's just very fun to play, very basic. It's like kind of stripped down to ease. I've heard it's compared to the Zwei games as well. You have like your main character just kind of has like a 3-hit combo at a jump, and you have a magic partner and some spells.
What more do you fucking need? What more do you fucking need?
Yeah, just you and your fairy. All the stages have... one of the main gimmicks is like the seasonal thing. Like when each stage has like the initial version will be like, oh, it's springtime now. And then later in the story, you get access to the summertime version and it's harder enemies. And then you beat the game and you go into the post game. No, now you've got the autumn version of the stage and it's even harder. And then apparently once you'd actually do New Game Plus, then you get access to the fourth season for every stage.
Oh,
which is like even harder. So they really reuse, just recycle,
really
repurpose
their use out of those environments.
So I never actually got to the fourth versions because you don't have to do all that to beat the game.
Right.
So like the first area will be like spring, then the second area will start at summer. So you're not seeing the same season all the time. The story in this one just goes really hard. Like it starts as like this quaint little, you know, action RPG, and just it goes big and fun in a way that I love. Mm-hmm. And it's like, again, we said it earlier of like, oh, you told a whole Trails arc in one game. It's just like, no, it's, again, sometimes games are just allowed to have like a 10-hour climax that goes ridiculous.
Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
Because this game goes big and then it ends. But again, like Granblue Fantasy, it leaves a little bit dangling in the ending. And then you unlock the third version of every stage and you do some more stuff. And then you get the true ending. It's just, it was very satisfying. Yeah. I had a great time.
That sounds great.
Yeah. Just very simple. Back to
how would you compare it with E7?
E7, I would, just to be general, I would probably put it in a similar category. Even though I think I personally liked it more. I think they're very comparable, I would feel.
I like E7, so yeah, that's a win.
Like graphically, I think pretty much exactly the same kind of era of colorful. This game is so colorful. Like they just went kind of nuts with the art design in this.
This is kind of like the Falcom that I really like a lot, is when they're kind of like throwing colors around and not afraid to like make a world that looks just like lively and fun.
And there's still sprites.
Yeah.
Are there? I don't remember that, actually.
This one?
Oh, okay.
I think they had moved past sprites, but like, it's still...
You're right, E7 was models. But they're cute models.
They're Final Fantasy VII. Proportion models.
Yeah.
Like, it's sort of like how there's E6 Origin, Oath of Fel'Ghana, and then there's E8, 9, 10. But then there's kind of this era that's like the E7,
they didn't make many E's games in that era.
Yeah. Well, and then the E4, the Memories one.
Memories are still set up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, I like this game a whole lot. It's just very unpretentious, I guess.
That's I love that about Falcom.
Yeah, I like Falcom when they can just be like, hey, let's make a cute little adventure.
Yeah. So next up, Polly.
We got another listener list. This comes in from the greatest streamer on Twitch.tv. It's our good pal, Grims. Gremlins are us. She says, hi, SoxCast. Here are my top three for 2024. John, get that tally out.
This oh, boy. This one's getting close.
Now we're going to start getting close. Balatro is as hypnotic as it is intuitive. I never thought I'd get much out of a deck-building roguelike themed around poker hands, but I somehow clocked 90 hours this year.
Ugh.
That's doesn't shock me. Next one, Doronko Wonko. I played this. This is a very fun, free little game where you play as a dog. This is a fun as heck, and it's free on Steam. It's only like an hour, but it's so satisfying to run around the house as a Pomeranian and just cause a ruckus. Yeah, this game is just an absolute delight. Play it. Like, you like small games, John. Doronko Wonko. Which I think just means drunk dog. I think Doronko may just be like a play on drunk.
Oh.
And Wonko is just like dog. Oh, or like Wan, which is like the sound a dog makes, and Ko. It's just child. So yeah, I think that's what they're going for, is like drunk dog. And finally, another Crab's Treasure caught my attention as it was made by the same devs as Going Under. I adore the setting. The combat is really satisfying, and I love the different abilities you can use with the shells. Little buggy, but a small price to pay for being able to play as a crab wearing a party hat. Yeah, I can dig that.
I've heard that game compared to Souls of all things.
Weirdly enough, yes. That's what I have heard as well, and I just, like, I've not played it, and I've not watched much of it, but that is interesting. If she made Dark Souls with a crab. Anyway, cool. With much love, Grims, heart emoji, and hey, heart emoji, right back to you. John!
That's me?
It's time. We need
it's time for my number five?
Five.
Oh, number man.
Pressure's on.
This... I don't have an explanation, y'all. This one just took over my brain. It took over my brain for like a month. It's not like, it's not Namco games. I don't know. It's my number five is Pokemon Mystery Dungeon Explorers of
Sinnoh. Yeah, I knew this one was coming. I knew this was going to be on here at some point. I'm not mad at it because I think Mystery Dungeon games are cool.
I just got obsessed.
Yeah,
it was just my world.
Yeah.
I was like, it's not even, it's really easy. Like, as a mystery dungeon game, this is baby's first mystery dungeon for sure.
Yeah.
Like, I still got my ass kicked for like the first 10 hours or so. And then I figured it out, and then I cruised through the rest of the game. Like, if you're here for a mystery dungeon, there's an unlockable post game dungeons where that are like, there's at least one that's just, you're put to level one solo, no items. It's just a roguelike. And there's 100 floors. This is just a roguelike now.
Here's the roguelike part.
So there is meat here. I didn't get far that one. I was tired because I played this game for 40 fucking hours.
Yeah.
There's just like an ineffable quality to it. The writing's just there. It's just cute. It's cute, and it goes so much harder than you expect. Yep. It goes so much harder than any mainline Pokemon game.
That's like watching you post the things that you were posting about this game in the Discord and on social media was just kind of like, what is happening? This is like a Pokemon game. Like,
that's what I'm telling you. So you know why I play? I was, Cecile had a list of like top 700 songs from like a Japanese site voter list. And we were just going down the list, listening to different songs. And one of them was Pokemon Mystery Dungeon. And we put it on and it was like, oh, this rips. This is a really good song. And then I scrolled down to the comments and people were posting these quotes from the game. And it was just like,
what is going on here?
What is happening? This is a Pokemon game. There's like tearful.
Oh my
like
God.
Fair, like death speeches. And I'm like, this isn't Pokemon. What the fuck's going on here?
Are you doing that RPG Maker thing where you make up a fake scene?
You're making up like a fake scene to set to this song? No. No, it's all there in the game.
Wild.
It's fucking nuts. It's not like great, but who cares? I just got dumbstruck by it. It's the combination of the music. The mystery dungeon loops are really pleasant, even though they're easy. The music, I already said the music's great. And just all of the incidental character interactions with your Pokemon are just cute as hell. They're just, I just love all of them. I love my partner, my Cyndaquil partner. I love him so much. And he loves me. My Totodile partner in Pokemon Explorers of Sky was the first boy that ever loved me.
Jesus Christ.
That's really sweet. So I think the main game's good. And then the special episodes that were added in Explorers of the Sky, especially the fifth special episode, pushed it over to just like something completely next level. Like there's two halves of the climax with two different sets of characters, and you only see one in the main game, which was also the only one you saw in the original Explorers of Time and other one release. And then you see the second half of that in Special Episode 5, and the two tie together really, really well, and I really think you need both for it to work. Mm-hmm. There's a whole post-game story after that. It's not very good. And it's very grindy to get there, so just play that main game and play the special episode, and it's just something special, y'all. It's just nice. I really like this game. I want to play every Pokemon Mystery Dungeon game. It's so cute. Fuck.
When the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon just fucking hits.
When yo, Crowfile. Oh my god. The tears I shed for what's fuck Dusknoir and Grovyle in this game. there are like 3 or 4 points where I cried at this game.
Oh my god.
It's just like it's just a really cute, good YA novel. It's just very nice.
I think of everything John has listed thus far, this is the one I would be most likely to get into.
Fuck yeah. Like I've got a portable console coming in the mail. I think I could make a little room for this in my diet just to kind of see. Sure.
I was curious. So I just, instead of like playing the entire game, I just watched one of the endings on YouTube, like the main story ending of the special episode. And I was just like, okay, yeah, this does actually have some writing chops. What's going on here?
What the fuck?
Like, it was like the cutscene before the final boss is like this riveting 12-minute.
Oh my god!
It's insane. They play this song called "Through the Seas of Time." It has like the same like story energy motion of like the epic theme and going to the lavas fighting Chrono Trigger. Except you're riding a Lapras.
Yeah, buddy. Yeah, you are.
And then you crash the Lapras into Lavos.
Honestly, more or less. There's a lot of Chrono Trigger DNA in this.
All right. It's very good. I'm in. Let's go.
It's nuts. I fucking love Explorers of Sky. And apparently the next one is jankier to play, but the story like hits a lot of folks about as hard. So I'm excited. Cool. The first one sounds like it's really just kind of light and goofy, kind of more what you'd expect from a mystery dungeon, From a Pokemon game, but it still looks cute. That's what, yeah. I think this is actually the most retcore of the top 10.
That's insane. It's the Pokemon Mystery Dungeon game. Jesus Christ. Yeah. All right. Well, if that is it, I do believe we have an audio list.
Okay.
Coming in from our good pal Raven, which we will be playing in 3, 2, 1.
The card wouldn't have kept me waiting. But still, I forgive you. Hello, greetings and salutations, gentle beings. I, Raven, have decided to grace you all with my participation in your quaint little annual celebration. Do try to contain your excitement. I'm sure you're wondering why I'm talking like Q from Star Trek. But why not? After all, my game of the year number 3 is the simply named Star Trek Borg. A delightfully clever interactive movie, you play as a Starfleet cadet time-traveling to save his own father, with the playful intervention of Q, played by John Delancey himself. Oh, I hear your skepticism. Little tricks like dying in order to get vital clues, and sometimes progressing by doing nothing at all? Dated and cliché, you declare. Well, this little gem might just surprise you with its charms. It's been preserved online by a fan, and it's a short play, so why not take a walk on the nostalgic side, mon capitaine? And next, yes, I know what you're thinking. Do I have for you, on my list, a turn-based puzzle-like strategy game with over-the-top characters and cute retro graphics? Well, I can't help having impeccable taste. Number two is Tactical Breach Wizards.
Oh, yeah.
In this game, the powers of your witty and colorful squad mates flip the usual combat mechanics upside down. Ooh. Like your healer who can revive you from death, meaning she has to shoot you dead first, and your sniper, who has deadly aim as long as he predicts where his future target is moving to. Also intriguing is the setting of a world where magic is weaponized science, and the plot of a rogue mercenary bent on starting World War III. It's a refreshing treat for your brain and funny bone. Ah, the piece de resistance, the numero uno, the debut of a longtime community member, and the very brightest of stars this year. Azazora, Ancient Abyss,
yo!
A tightly focused RPG Maker game from our very own Iffy. It brings the very essence of a much longer adventure and a whole fleshed-out world down into a story with one journey and a single main character. I had so much fun playing as the energetic, plucky ninja girl and carefully managing resources to explore every inch of the dungeons. Brilliant, magnifico, just plain fun and touching, to be quite honest. Since you don't have all the time an omnipotent being like me has, I must bid you all adieu, auf Wiedersehen, sayonara, until the next occasion your puny planet completes a whole solar orbit.
All right. I love it when people ham it
Thank
up
you, Raven.
On these lists.
Beautiful.
And big congrats to Iffy. Like, I'm so glad that she was finally able to get a game out. Like,
yeah.
It's been something she's really tried to get going for a long time, and life is comes at you sometimes. And mm-hmm. I am so glad that she got to finish this, and it ended up so good.
Cool.
Fuck yeah.
Like, yeah, we're going to, yeah. If he gets a little extra shine, I'm sorry. There's favoritism at play on this podcast. But when your wifey is involved, sometimes, you know how it be.
I really liked Azora. I'm really glad if he got to make a game.
Azora was a fantastic. All right, we have another listener list coming in.
Fucking,
from
this is how this beat my Bombi score. Damn it.
Rip.
Okay, this comes in from Ghosty.
Yay!
Ghosty says, I did not play very many games at all this year. It seemed like I just bounced off most things I tried. So this year is a shorter list. Number two, Planet Attrition.
What?
Yeah! Two mentions!
Yeah!
Simple and engaging.
Put that one down.
Simple and engaging, surprisingly strategic. I finally beat John at a score attack game.
Get dunked on, nerd!
Oh my god, I got crushed on that one like immediately.
So bad, too.
And number one, Trails from Zero.
Oh.
I adore this little game. At least that's how it feels compared to Trails in the Sky. It's just one small cast, one complete plot, mostly. Maybe the characters overall aren't as strong, but still very good. For me, at least, one character does much to make the game land. The writing is very strong, and they don't get distracted or carried away with the story, nor does it overstay its welcome. Everything ties up very nicely at the end. Just a perfect story start to finish.
We love Tio.
Yep.
Which trail said that one more time?
Zero.
Yeah. Oh, man.
That one's real strong. It's got that real strong ending. That real strong... A real strong story beat that they follow up from third.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, Zero is...
That is definitely the closest to a complete package that one of those games gets.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's
just, as long as you played the previous three.
As long as you played the previous three.
I think SC is as close as you get to that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Come on.
Okay. I'll give you that. All right. So we're on to number four.
Okay.
And I get to start out. All right. I'm getting us there. So up next in games that you don't expect to be as good as they actually are, we got Gal Guardians Demon Purge.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, baby. Yeah.
I wasn't sure when this was, like, on the cutting block for me if you would list it.
Oh, no, no. This was not even close. This was on every iteration of my list. So this game was always safe. Like, this is, like, the very definition of a passion project, like we said. Yeah. Like, this is a game the creator wanted to make for years. He finally got to do it. And he did everything he wanted to do with it, top to bottom. Mm-hmm. Like, we went over this one last episode, so I won't you know, do a lot of repeating things we did. This is just a damn good action platformer. Like, when this game came out and it was revealed, oh, this is part of the Gal Gun series, so many people just got so up their ass about it. Like, in a way that was just like, dude, you sound like a fucking clown right now. Like, you were literally playing this game one stream ago and having a fantastic time, and then you found out it was part of Gal Gun and you were shitting your pants. Like, stop. You sound like a goddamn moron. Like, a good game is just a damn good game. And again, like, while this game does have a bit of horny in it, it's not really focused on that. And a lot of the time, it's literally just kind of being done for the absurd. Like, there's nothing here that's trying to be titillating, I think.
It's just very cheesecake silly.
Like, it's very, like the main character is named, like, Honey, which is literally horny. Come on.
Stupid.
There's a guy character that gets introduced, you know, a little bit in, and he's like, he's close. Yeah,
and they call him like Ho-Nee-san.
Yeah, they call him Ho-Nee-san.
So and Honey.
It's literally horny. So,
Red-san.
Yeah, this game is just super solid to play. Like, there's loads of extra collectibles and stuff. There's an incredibly difficult difficulty after you complete the game. I don't remember what it's called. I know it's like something like ridiculous or something. I don't know. But I got about halfway through that. The enemy placements are so mean.
Wait, really? It's different enemy placements?
Oh, the enemy placements are so fucked up.
Oh, see, I didn't know about this.
Oh, it's so hard. I literally learned the first half of this game speedrun because I almost wanted to kind of play it more. I played through this game back to back like two times. And then nice. I played it again while we were doing while I was doing considerations. So I played this game three times.
Oh shit.
I like this fucking game awesome. A lot. I think this game is great. I think people need to just get past the fact that it is a Gal Gun game. It is a fun little story in its own right. It's having a laugh at itself. And it is one of the best feeling little action platformers that I played this year. It just is like, there's like some really fun, like, sub weapon category or synergies that I found. It was just like, wait a minute, you can do this? There's just a lot of fun to be had with this game. And I think that if you like games like those Bloodstained, Curse of the Moon, stuff like that, or even stuff like Shovel Knight, like, this is a game that is going to be, you will like this. It's good. It's fantastic. Go play Gal Guardians Demon Purge, please.
Oh, yeah.
The funny thing is, I've never been really into Castlevania at all. Mm-hmm. So this is probably my favorite Castlevania-like.
Yeah, I think that's totally fine. Like, this game's great. It's got that whole vibe. It's got great music. It's got fun characters. It's just top to bottom. Like, there's nothing really wrong with this game. It's just top to bottom. A perfect little package, I think.
A-plus game feel.
A-plus game. Yeah. Dude, I remember playing that fucking Love Live game. earlier in the year. And then like when I played the demo for this, I was like, holy shit. It's literally night and day in terms of game feel. Like, how did you fuck up this bad with that Love Live game? They could have had another one of these on their hands and they just like, God, whatever that was. But yeah, Gal Guardians, Demon Purge.
Beautiful.
It's the truth. John! Okay.
I've got a list from Toasty.
Hey!
Hi, I'm still Toasty, also known as Dare Tomaten Toaster, and I will once again send in a last-minute submission with the three objectively best games I played this year. Number three, Helen's Mysterious Castle, a small JRPG with small numbers that's big fun. It managed to make every enemy feel like its own puzzle, making each action much more meaningful and never random in the slightest once you have figured out the opponent's attack patterns. Excuse me. More JRPGs should take at least some amount of inspiration from this instead of throwing larger and larger amounts of stats at me that I can't possibly take into full consideration at any given time. That is two Helen's Mysterious Castle mentions in 2014.
Yeah. The game that still keeps going.
RPG Maker game.
I feel like people keep discovering this one and we're the ones championing it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Fucking killing it. Number two, Mouthwashing, my favorite narrative game of the year. Does everything it sets out to do within the runtime of a medium-length movie, making it hit that much harder due to barely ever having any downtime, aside from letting you explore the very limited environments. Jumping back and forth between two perspectives, one in the past and one in the present, was the perfect way to let the players slowly come to their own conclusions about the characters and unfolding events, with some of the story's biggest strengths being the things that weren't quite said until the very end. Hyper Demon, number one, insanely fast-paced arcade FPS. You need to be a certain amount of insane to ever wrap your head around all the different possibilities the surprisingly deep mechanics give you, and then still combine those effectively without wasting time or dying. Honestly, I'm not on that level of insanity, and I'm not sure whether I will ever be able to reach the end of this game. But despite that, climbing the leaderboard and seeing how many people gave up before me is probably the most satisfying high score hunting experiences I've ever had. Please add me on Steam so I can beat your score. Thanks. Love you, Polly, and other people, but mostly Polly.
Thanks,
I'm glad
Toasty.
Mouthwashing. I'm glad Mouthwashing got a mention.
Yeah, this is one I definitely want to play. Like, I've tried to stay pretty blind to it because I feel like it's a narrative game.
I have no idea.
Totally up my alley. I just know that everything I've seen about it is like, yep, I'm playing that. And who doesn't like clean mouthfeel, really?
What if your mouth gets too clean because you're drinking mouthwash?
I don't know. I kind of just really like a clean mouth feel. I don't think that my mouth could be too clean. I think I just really like it.
Maybe your throat and stomach won't agree.
No, they won't. No, they'd hate it. They'd absolutely hate it. But Rhett!
Oh, boy.
We're back to you again. Number four.
We're in it.
We're in it. You're in it to win it like Iserman.
When I saw what was coming up next, I started wincing. Oh, boy. Oh, we're in the real shit now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I told John a few months ago that I was going to play this game. I was going to cry a lot at the end, and it was going to be my game of the year.
Oh.
It's not my game of the year, but it's very high.
All right.
I don't know what this is.
My number four is Aquarium.
I knew it!
Oh, yeah!
I knew this one was coming in! We hadn't heard it yet, and I knew it was probably going to be high.
I was like, are they even going to know what this is?
Yeah, I know what Aquarium is.
I remember Aquarium.
Yeah.
You should tell it to the audience.
You should explain it to the audience, however.
This one needs so much explanation, given all the events surrounding it. This is a Hololive-themed visual novel. Directed and written, like, the last credit in this game is, like, written by Minato Aqua.
Yeah, like the person the game is about.
Yeah, the character the game is about. But, like, she's in the credits as, like, story and producer, which is very funny to me. She graduated from Hololive a few months ago. Mm. This game came out originally in Japan in 2022, and then it got localized to everyone's shock in 2023.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I'll put that on my wish list. I'll play that eventually. And then I waited a year, and then she announced her graduation. I'm like, fuck. I guess I got to play it now. And I think there's a little context needed for her graduation is that no one had graduated from Hololive in like 2 years, and for Hololive Japan, 3 years. It was just not a thing that happened. And since then, there's been a bunch more announcements kind of coming rapid fire all of a sudden.
Yeah, it's kind of been an exodus in a way.
It's not really a huge exodus, but the 1-2 punch, there were two within 2 days, which was just when you're going from 2 years to a day between announcements.
Yeah.
Just
like, huh. It's rough.
Okay, something kind of does seem up. But anyways, when she announced her graduation, it was still a special event, and she got this whole month to herself.
Yeah.
Before the sky fell.
Yeah.
So I was playing this in the immediate aftermath. And it was the perfect timing because she also hadn't reincarnated as a new persona yet. So when I played this game, she was gone, and that was very important to the emotional reaction I had to this.
Oh man.
This is a very, very cute and fluffy visual novel. It makes no, like, it doesn't hide what it is. It is a game for fans of her, and basically makes the assumption that you're in love with her. Like, the whole thing is about dating her, like 90% of it.
Fantastic. I want to make, like, an entire game about dating me.
It is a little self-absorbed if you think about it that way. It is a gift to her fans, you could say.
I'm dating Minato Aqua.
Yes. I think the humor is actually really good. I laughed a lot at this. There's two side routes that are optional for other Hololive members that are just very, very silly, like the founding of a new kingdom based on curry or something. It's bizarre. Or running off to be a pirate with Marine.
It's very, like I played a similar visual novel this year where it was very jokey, and it feels like a very similar thing where I married somebody and they became my potato wife.
Beautiful. The reason this got all the way up to number 4 is because the ending really caught me off guard.
Is it because she was gone and already, or is it because it was just an emotional ending?
It's a very emotional ending, no matter what. Mm-hmm. But when mixed with the real world fact that she was gone,
yeah,
made it fucking devastating. And I had heard that the ending was sad and that you're gonna have an emotional reaction to it. But I got completely caught off guard of what the ending actually is, because there are some plot threads that just go absolutely nowhere. The ending really caught me off guard and was like, oh, okay, we're doing this now, huh? Oh, we're in the end game all of a sudden. I don't want to spoil it, even though I don't think anybody here is going to be in audience for this. Yeah. But this was probably the hardest I cried at a game all year a huge margin.
Oh my god!
That's
so good.
This was like cry for 2 hours during the ending, take an hour to recompose myself, then open it back up, go to one of the earlier save files and read it again, and still start crying all over again. And then I attempted to open the Fuamoco stream where they played it.
Oh no.
And I go to towards the end game, and they're basically holding back tears.
Jesus Christ.
And I see it, and I see a chat message that just says, all caps, I am in so much pain right now. And I couldn't do it. I couldn't get through that.
I'm out.
But if there's
bail.
If I ever wanted to just fucking rip my soul out, I'm going to load up that full video again.
Oh my god.
Maybe I should tell Polly the ending afterwards.
You can tell me too.
You can just drop it in chat afterwards.
Yeah, this one, it got me good. That's all I can say. Yeah, I enjoyed it a lot.
Yeah, I had a feeling... You were posting a lot about this one, talking a lot about it. I saw a lot of it from you, and I knew that this was probably going to be on your list somewhere. So,
yeah, I think number 4 was a solid entry.
Solid pick.
Again, when I call the top 5 the games.
The perfect games, right?
Yeah. So, do you got a listener list?
We got a listener list from our good pal, Gesh. 86, who for some reason is credited in this list as Gesh 88.
I'm sorry.
Maybe it's that we got a new version of Gesh after all these years. He finally updated to the 88 model of his name, I guess. But it's also funny that Tomato and Toaster is also German. So we got both German lists, like both German guest lists together. That's pretty fun. So
it's a time zone thing. That's they sent their list together, basically.
Yeah, there you go. So happy holidays, SoxCast. Please excuse the last minute submission. It was choice paralysis for the third place that always kept me from completing a list. Now that it's all or nothing, here goes. Number one, and I'm shocked that this is the first time I'm hearing this one. Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree. That can't be a game of the year. I'm kidding. That's a dumb that's a dumb joke. That's a dumb Game Awards joke. Anyway, such a rich and fantastic DLC. It could have been called Elden Ring 2, and it probably wouldn't have even disappointed. It really reminded me how much I adored the main game 2 years ago. That game was 2 years ago? Oh my God.
I would say it was only 2 years ago.
I'm having a crisis right now. The main game 2 years ago, and even made me do another, the fourth playthrough of it, after I was done with the Land of Shadow.
Holy shit, four playthroughs.
Some people really like themselves some Elden Ring.
That one's like 100 hours long, though. But Elden Ring's too big.
God. Number two, Black Myth Wukong. I returned to Monk. A monkey? Is it monkey. That's the joke.
It's monkey.
I returned to Monkey. I don't know why I read it as a monk. I've literally known this phrase, return to monkey, for years. I've returned to monkey. Extremely satisfying combat and stunning in visuals and art style. I was one of the people who barely knew about Wukong through Dragon Ball, so the more mythologically authentic setting of the fairy tale really gripped me here. And number three, Toho, Hero of Ice Fairy.
I figured there's one coming.
Yeah, there had to be. It's a guess list.
Oh, that's another. That's another.
That's another cheer. I'm tracking.
I'm tracking my Toho count. Oh, I think we're at three.
Okay. We have so many counters now. An action game that is very similar to Toho 17.5, but might even come out on top in direct comparison. The bullet hell in it is both challenging and incredibly flashy. The art style is lovely and even a little kinky at times. But not so naughty that I'd mind. For Toho standards, it has a surprisingly good story, too. That's a very funny qualifier. All that said, have a good time. Bispald. Dash 86. John!
Is my number four? Typing and compiling the numbers.
I love that. Like, that is a constant throughout this whole show this time around. Is we just hear we hear a game said and John just clack 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 clack.
Like, I didn't realize it was that loud. I'm sorry.
Well, you can't change it now because we got to keep it consistent. So
okay,
all right. So John, I need a number four.
Okay. Fuck. Sorry.
Did you just forget what your own number four was?
Duh. Yeah, no, of course. It's been 5 hours. All right. I'm in there.
It's been 5 hours since you lost your sanity.
Oh man. So I played this. So again, the running theme here, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon and Tales of Phantasia don't really fit the theme here. The theme this year is collections of smaller games.
Sure.
This one is an anthology. This is Anthology of the Killer.
Anthology of the Killer. All right. I was thinking this.
Yep. Fucking love this game. So I kind of talked about it. I wrote a little review of this one. I played Katamites' games for years. Mm-hmm. And I've really enjoyed and respected them. I remember in 2013, someone made a list of new freeware games that came out. And they were like they put my game Quarantine next to a new Katamites game, Lake of Roaches. Oh, and I felt so starstruck. I was like, I'm being considered in the same breath as a Katamites game. Holy shit. But I've also like kind of bounced off a lot of his stuff over the years. I think I complained on here when I played Magic Wand.
Yeah.
because that's when it's presented like kind of an RPG. And the fighting is deliberately like nothing, which is fine. But it also, the story doesn't go anywhere. It's like deliberately a joke. Like they kind of set up promises and then deflate them on purpose. Mm-hmm. And then the game just kind of ends. And I was like, what on earth? Ah, it's very anti-John in a lot of ways.
Right. Yeah.
But like, he's doing this shit on purpose. He's been doing this shit on purpose. It's all like in pursuit of a specific effect.
Yeah.
You read his games crit. You play his games and it all kind of comes together. I think the ones that really landed for me before Anthology of the Killer were stuff like Murder Dog 4, Trial of the Murder Dog, which I just replayed with Cecile. It's still a fucking all-time banger. Because those are, they're so short that there's not really much time for like setting up a big promise of what's going to happen. Fucking microphone keeps falling.
You're so excited. You just keep knocking the microphone over.
I think Anthology of the Killer strikes a balance. It's almost like it kind of meets me halfway, where it's still very much like where it, the thing that Anthology of the Killer keeps doing throughout its all nine games that were all published kind of anonymously at first on Game Jolt, which rules, and then under a pseudonym, and then he put them all together later. Oh, so fucking cool. Is that his control of the language, these are all Unity games, his control of the language of Unity horror game is perfect, where he'll just do this like extended setup of something legitimately kind of spooky and eerie, and then it just collapses into like into a really, really funny joke. He'll just completely suck the wind out of it with a really good joke.
This is a big reason of why I want to play these.
Yeah, they're not at all they're shitpost games in a way that really appeals to me, because it's the kind of shitpost you can only make when you're really, really good at the game that you're roasting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the characters are just really cute. This is the most like Blorbo filled Catamites game of my life. I love BB. I love ZZ. I love all of them. They're fucking adorable. And it's just really, really funny. I think the one that really brought me in was the third one. I think that's, Drool of the Killer, which takes place in like a haunted pool. And it just like, it just kind of clicked for me. And I just got completely into the comic voice. They're very text heavy, like, BB is constantly commenting on what's going on. And her character voice is just perfect. It's so funny. Like Catamites games have been funny like this for a decade plus. But just something about how this one is put together just kind of unlocked it for me and clicked together in my head. And I just straightforwardly adored it. If you're up for something that definitely does not take itself seriously, and not like a roasting, but like something sort of a parody of like the language of Unity horror games.
It's a riff.
It's something that I really, really enjoyed. It's a bunch of really gorgeous 3D spaces with really funny, pitch perfect writing. So I can't recommend Anthology of the Killer enough.
Cool.
Yeah, this one is on the list as well. Like I've had it like in the old install folder for a while now, and it's just haven't gotten around to it yet, but absolutely want to. Like this, yeah, like everything about like what I've read about it and the people that I've heard talk about it. It's like, yep, that's a me awesome jam if ever there was one.
Yeah, I think this one it all comes together so well.
Yeah. Yep.
I really want to play 10 Beautiful Postcards, and I really want to play 50 Short Games, where he literally took like a month and a half and made a new game on Glorious Trainwrecks every day for 50 days.
Jeez.
And then put it all together with a launcher. Freaking killer.
Get out of here. UFO so cool. 50. All right. So if that is your number four, then I do believe we have what I believe to be our final audio list of the year.
The final countdown.
The final countdown. Now you know we're getting into the thick of it. The final audio list of the year comes from our good pal Sunday.
Yay, Sunday.
And I will be pressing play on that in 3, 2, 1, go.
Hi, Sox. Sunday here. Here are my top three games for the year. First of all, we have Pangya Reborn. This is a Korean golf MMO private server. And I just remember, like, the first day that I opened it, I just smiled from ear to ear entire time. Like, I was just overjoyed at, like, being in that space and, like, witnessing that community and also dressing up the little characters. It's so cute. Yeah, I just, like, was filled with joy the entire time. And it's been really nice, like, seeing that community kind of thrive and, you know, kind of, like, take ownership of this defunct game. And I've learned that I just really love that. Like, I love kind of seeing the alternate histories or alternate presence that private servers can kind of map out. You know, I've been playing TF2 Classic. There's a Minecraft mod for the beta version that imagines, like, a separate development track it could have gone on. I just really like the idea of kind of creating an alternate history for what a game could have been. And cultivating, like, a very small community around that where you tend to see the same players over and over again. It's beautiful.
Awesome.
After that, my number two game, Home R Where the Heart Is. So I'm fairly certain this was featured in an event that Nilsson put on, Nilsson from Vextro. And first of all, I think it just opened me up to, like, how games could interact with those fine art spaces. I think I'm very interested in that. And honestly, it's something that I'd maybe want to incorporate into my own work someday, maybe. But I don't know, just like when I opened this game, you know, I've played like 50 short games. I've played like a couple other games that are like little kind of one system sketches and stuff like that. And this is the game that finally made it click for me, like, oh yeah, I'm like super invested in games being this. Like, I love the idea of a game that is just like one interaction that is like very evocative. And just like seeing what you can do with that and letting a game kind of be its own installation, that really excites me. But the number one game for me of 2024, you'll be happy to hear this, it's Seabed.
Yeah!
It just captures so much about cognition and interpersonal relationships in a way that really interests me. And honestly, ever since I played that game, I like haven't looked at the world the same way. Is that strange to say? It's just one of those games. It's a game that describes everything in such intimate detail. And the entire time you're thinking, why is it doing this if I still don't understand what's happening? And it strings you along like that for a while until suddenly it just all clicks into place and your whole schema for thought has been wrapped around what this game's themes are. Highly recommend to just anybody, you know, and there is Yuri. So yeah, number one game. Thank you to everybody here who recommended that I play that. So appreciated. All right, looking forward to 2025. Maybe this one will actually be the year of the Vita. I didn't really play it that much this year.
Vita means life, by the way.
Absolutely. Saga never dies.
Seabed, getting its due, yeah. Baby. Let's
That's
go.
Two mentions.
Nice.
Killer. Video games are so good, y'all. I'm so happy.
Yeah. I like
shout out to Nilsson. Holy shit.
But yeah. Yeah. Solid
also,
list.
Also 250 short game mentions in a row.
Yeah, that was good. Again, we can't know that's gonna happen because we don't know each other's lists. So that's really fun. Yeah.
Sunday was really sweet while I was taking a drawing class this year.
Aw.
Really appreciated it.
Nice. I do believe we have another listener list though. Rhett,
one more.
Help us out here.
This was posted by Durante in the Discord. I guess it counts. This list says Death of a Wish, Game of the Year / Game of the Decade.
Fuck yeah.
Final Fantasy VII Rebirth runner up. Like a Dragon Infinite Wealth, honorable mention. Dragon Quest III, honorable mention. Is there a new one, a remake of that?
There is a Dragon Quest III.
There is it's an HD 2D remake. It's like Octopath.
I'm assuming it's that the new one, yeah, probably. Yeah, I don't actually know.
Yeah, that was the one they played.
Yeah, it looks like Octopath.
So that's another point for Like a Dragon and for FF7 Rebirth,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Cool. And finally, Death of a Wish fucking rules. I played the first hour. I have to be in a specific mood to play a Devil May Cry like, but it seems like it's the sequel to Luca Born of the Dream, and it feels really tight. It seems really, really strong, y'all. I'm really excited to dig deep on it.
Cool. Okay, closing out this list is Metaphor. It'd be mean to leave it off just because I only started playing it in December, and it's a lot of fun.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah, like I'm kind of excited to give that game a look. I like with Persona 3 Reload. Like, okay, I'm ready to love again. Fine, we'll do it. Like, I'll do it. I'll try. And everybody that I've talked to that's played Metaphor: ReFantazio seemed to have a really good time with it. And spoken pretty highly of how it handles its politics, so I'm really eager to see, given, you know, Atlas.
Yeah.
Actually,
I just realized that's another list with Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth, and Metaphor.
Yep. A lot of crossover there.
The saviors of JRPG, turn-based.
Yep. Turn-based RPGs are the future, people. That's where it really is. All right, so are we ready for number 3?
Oh, man, we're in there.
Are we ready to cross over into the cream of the crop, the very best? Oh, boy. Are we ready?
Yeah.
Yes.
All right, here we go. So I don't know about how you feel about this, but for me, it's honestly the best feeling in the world when a long journey finally pays off, when you finish something that you started a number of years ago, and it actually sticks to landing on everything it's mostly trying to do. My number 3 is Mary Skelter Finale.
Oh. Yeah.
So I began this journey back in, I think it was 2018 when Nightmares released here in the States. And in 2024, I have finally put a cap on the Mary Skelter series. And I can say without a doubt, absolutely a journey that was worth taking.
Awesome.
If ever... I guess maybe it comes with a caveat. Like, if ever there was a dungeon crawler marketed to and created exactly for me, it would have to be Mary Skelter. It's grimdark and edgy and stylish in all of these little choony-ass high school ways. Loads of cute girls. They're all over the place. Game's just brimming with cute girls. Fantastic characters. And this game has enough damn story that it could just be visual novels and it would be like still 70 to 80 hours a piece. Like, this is not a game that skimps on the stories. It is a series that has always had, I think, a very unique identity. Like, I think that, like, when I look at this game, like, I can't think of anything that looks like what it's going for visually. And that's something that just kind of always stood out. And I think that carries through to its gameplay, where it tries to do unique things with its dungeon crawling by giving every character a unique ability that works in the dungeon for you to solve puzzles with. And then there's the nightmare aspect, where you have unbeatable bosses that can only be beaten once you've made a certain amount of progress into the dungeon. And if they corner you, you have to fucking knock them down and run. Like, you actually have to run away from them. Like, they appear as an enemy. Like, it's not like a random encounter or anything. They just pop up, they start chasing you, and your map goes away. So you've got to just kind of, like, hope that you remembered where you were in the dungeon. Because those things can actually just really fuck your day up. And yes, this is a series that does have enough of that Idea Factory jank that will probably deter a lot of people. But I thoroughly enjoyed every game in this series, and I think Finale just wraps everything up, like, in a really good way. I think that my favorite part of it is that But and it works. This functions as both like gameplay and story. Is that every character in this story is important, and every character in the gameplay is important, because the main cast gets split up into three separate groups very early on in the story, and so you now have three unique groups that you are in control of throughout the entire game, and you have to use every single character. Like, you can't just like, oh, I like these five characters, so I will carry them through, and that'll be... You can't. Because every team has exactly five members, and you have to use them all. And there is no... Like, and I think that that's
so smart.
It really is. It does bog things down when you have to like stop and re-equip everybody and learn skills and reclass. It does make that part of the game way longer, and maybe a little more tedious, because you are outfitting 15 characters.
The Trails third.
A normal Trails game.
Yeah, there you go. It's a normal Trails game. This is literally like a third of the size of a Trails game at this point. I like that, like, that they make it work both in terms of gameplay and story, and like the dungeon crawling is also the way, like, they everybody loves the final dungeon of Final Fantasy VI, right, where you get three big parties that you have to like attack from all, like, you know, you have to attack the final dungeon from three different angles, and this entire game is that. You have three parties, and they all work to, like, solve each dungeon floor in tandem. And you have to, like, sometimes pass items back and forth, or one team has to solve a puzzle on their side to open up doors or open up or change, the geography of something on another team's side. So you're always kind of hopping back and forth. And the game does a good job of letting you know when a team has made progress to a point to where they can't progress anymore and do need somebody else to do something. I think that's actually really smart. So when you go into like the party select screen, there'll just be an icon. It's like, you know, if this team's done everything that they can do right now, go somewhere else, try something different. I think that that's really smart, because I think that you could probably get a little lost in the sauce with like big ass dungeons. Like, and you know, these things are like 50 by 50 or like 60 to 60 tiles a piece. And that's a lot. In a dungeon crawler, those are huge maps. I don't feel that Mary Skelter finale could have done more. Like, I feel like
landed in all the ways we needed it to.
Yeah, like it maybe a couple of story beats didn't land all that great, but in the end, like, I feel like this is a cast where I genuinely cared that they got the ending they deserved. Like, it was like seeing a blue sky for the first time in this series. That was weirdly emotional. Like, not only for the characters, but for me. Like, I was just they've never shown it. They've never had the chance to see an outside world. And it was just like, holy shit. I wasn't prepared for how hard that punched me in the chest. And then there's an epilogue visual novel included. Well, there's a shit ton of stuff included with finale that I won't go over. I'll just say that game oversells. Like, that game gives you way more than what you paid for. But there's an epilogue visual novel that takes place after the true finale of the game, where you can, as the protagonist, Jack, the boy, you can marry the girl of your choice.
Yeah!
So it's still a Trails game.
But I read them all, and they all work. And I think the reason why is because they've spent so much time over the course of this game making these character relationships feel real and tangible that, like, even if, like, Alice is very clearly the obvious canon choice. Like, there's no doubt about that from the first moment that you start Nightmares. It's like, oh, yeah, these two are a thing. They will be a thing. But the way all of the characters' dynamics has worked and the way that they've written their interactions over the course of these three games, even if you just choose to marry the girl you like the most, it doesn't feel weird or forced. It just feels like a thing that's like, yeah, that feels pretty natural.
That's so cool.
And I was not expecting that. Like, I went into that little epilogue visual novel kind of planning to be eye-rolly about, like, oh, yeah, let's do the harem thing now. And another thing that I like is they actually respect the canonical gay relationship throughout the entire series. You cannot date or have any kind of romantic interest in the gay couple that are already a couple. I think that's actually pretty rad.
Good.
In fact, they get their own little marriage scene at the end of the game, too. Like, and I think that's really, really good. But, like, again, this is, like, the probably, like, the most me choice any game could be. Like, everything about this series has just been me from start to finish. I just loved everything about it through all the jank, you know? It's just fantastic. Like, it's not a series that I can easily recommend to people because I know it's like 3 80-hour dungeon crawlers. They're kind of janky. They're not always the most balanced thing in the world. But man, the story really gets there.
Cool.
I mean, it's just fucking, it fucking rules when studios make these game series that are legitimately committed to their fiction.
Yeah, like this time. Is a series that has like spin-off novels and shit. Mm-hmm. Like this is literally Idea Factory Compile Heart's passion project. Like,
yeah,
it has a defined start and ending. It has a lot of little side stories that it helped paint the universe. Again, just flabbergasted at how good this thing has remained, especially considering who made it.
That's so dope.
Yep.
Idea Factory Redemption Arc.
Like, I remember one time I wrote them off after Death End Request pissed me off. But
I do remember that.
But then Mary Skelter Nightmares was like, oh, wait, no. You were like edgy and choony in all the ways that I love things to be.
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. Mary Skelter's the shit.
I'm really glad you got to. I remember how much fun you had with the first two games.
Oh,
and I was wanting, just at every step, I was wanting for you to get to this one and have it just land exactly the way you'd want it to.
And it did. Like, and I am so happy that, like, it, like, I love that it had a happy ending. I love that it felt genuinely earned. Like, it's just, you know, you've struggled all three games to get here, and it feels so amazingly good to finally. Again, just seeing Blue Sky was just. Like, I literally audibly gasped out loud the first time because I'd never seen it in these games before.
Awesome. So awesome.
Anyway, that's my Mary Skelter finale spiel. Cool. I do believe, John.
I do have a listener list from Millie.
You got a listener list? From Millie.
Longtime Sox fan Millie.
Hell yeah.
Wowie, I actually played some video games this year. Here's my picks. Number 3, Idle Nightmare 2, Sabbath. The latest collab between one-man video game factory Adrian Dittrich and pixel artist extraordinaire June Flower is, as the title suggests, an idle clicker game with a twist. Grind your way through your mundane day job or slip off to the dark woods to become something more. 3 unique endings, all obtainable in maybe half an hour if you know what you're doing. 18 plus. They cooked. Fuck yeah.
Yeah.
You got 18 plus idle clicker.
Yeah, right.
Hell yeah. Number 2, Anthology of the Killer.
Hey, there's another.
another in a row there. Maybe cheating a bit because it's more like 9 games in a funny wrapper, but in the year of UFO 50, I don't feel bad about that. Nobody does it like Stephen Gilmurphy. I would die for BBNZZ. Yep. Or become a future murder victim, as the case may be. Fantastic. Number 1, Atlas, spelled A-T-L-Y-S-S. I wasn't expecting the early access big booty furry bait online RPG to be the thing to completely assume me for the better part of a month, but 100 plus hours of playtime later, here we are. Its MMOisms are simplified enough for my baby gamer abilities, and the movement is fun enough to warrant hours of parkour trying to get out of bounds with friends. And I've met a surprising amount of cool people just jumping into random online lobbies, running dungeons, or just shooting the shit, or doing other things furries are known for that I'll leave to your imagination. Either way, the vibes are on point, and if its particular aesthetic doesn't put you off, there's a lot of enjoyment to be had just existing in this space. Awesome. Fucking awesome.
Like, a good year for early access and betas and demos, huh?
Yeah.
Good year.
That's 2 for Anthology of the Killer. It's on par with FF7.
There you go.
And also on par with Planet Attrition.
I just got to get Rhett to put Anthology of the Killer on there. It's going to put it right over.
Oh, it's coming. Don't worry. Maybe not this year, actually, though.
All right, Rhett, what's next?
So every year you and I like to make a joke thing where we write like Rhett Game of the Year 25.txt and list what we think are going to be our top 10 games of the year. And they're always wildly wrong.
Every time, no
I did
what.
This too, and mine, like, I don't think a goddamn thing I predicted ended up on my list.
Well, for once, one of my predictions was correct. Simply because I think I've been listing it for the last 4 years.
And it made a hell of a climb.
My number three is Outer Wilds.
Damn! About time.
I was waiting for this one.
I started this in 2020.
Jesus Christ. You love it when a saga has a good ending.
I started this in 2020 and then immediately started Trails Zero at the same time and got super hooked into that because Trails Zero ended up being my game of the year. And then Outer Wilds had some things that you needed to give full attention to it.
Well, they just announced that sequel, right?
No.
Yeah, they literally did just announce a sequel.
Right? This is the fall on New Vegas devs, right?
Yep, Obsidian.
Fuck off. There comes a point where people are like so unironically still making this confusion. Outer Wilds is the time loop indie game. It is not the Outer Worlds.
Come on, Rhett, you gotta appreciate a good bit.
I gotta appreciate a bit that just completely derails you in the middle of your thought.
Yeah, exactly. Again, I started playing this with Trails Zero of all things. Since then, I played Azure, four Cold Steel games, Referee, Daybreak, and then I finally got back to Outer Wilds.
Incredible.
Took a while.
And I just started over because I didn't remember anything.
Wait, took a break to play Zero?
Yeah.
That's so funny.
It was that long ago. It was 2020.
God.
The year we kind of forgot about. This game's really, really, really interesting because it's not like anything I've ever played. It is almost like a text-based narrative game in 3D with full movement and flying around your spaceship and stuff. But the vast majority of what you actually do is read. And that really threw me the first time. Like, what is interesting about this game is that, well, besides the story itself, but like mechanically, you do very little. You have so few verbs compared to most games. Like, you have a spaceship that you fly around to get places. It's not really involved in any of the puzzles. You have like a radio that you can point at and scan signals for. You have like a drone that you can shoot out and take pictures with. And I think that might be it. So like, you've basically got like three tools, and the way they make puzzles that don't feel like puzzles, they're invisible. You just have to know very, very specific interactions will do a thing. So it's like, so it's this game where you can just fly anywhere in the entire solar system from the start and just get extremely lost and confused as to what's going on. And the vast majority of the game is just finding these alien text logs and reading them and piecing together what is going on in this solar system.
Cool. Fucking cool.
And there's just this very small handful of true puzzle moments that, again, are invisible. Like, you don't realize the puzzle is there, what the game is asking you to do, until you've read the specific text log and go, oh, is this going to work? And then you do it and it does. And you're like, oh, holy shit. Like, there's one specific area. Well, there's the tutorial at the start of the game. And there's one area in the game that's like an actual training facility that very bluntly teaches you something. But like, the real important stuff is just these invisible world puzzles. And it's super
God,
neat.
That's so fucking cool.
I've watched a lot of people like play this game or talk about it. Like, I noticed like there's always like the one moment that jumps out to people, and it's different for everyone. It's not like one specific thing that happens. like every planet has like one of your a fellow alien explorer in the same race as you, and they're always like playing a musical instrument. And you find them with the radio or like the signal receiver. And if you fly to the edge of the solar system and you point all the you point your radio thing at the like the string of planets, like all their signals will line up and they're playing a song together, it turns out. And like you get a Steam achievement for that. And like God. I've seen somebody mention their that was like the moment for the game of the game for them. Mm-hmm. My moment to, for the in this game wasn't so happy.
Oops, oh, okay.
I forget how to exactly describe it, but it's like basically despite like the goofiness of the game and like the gravity physics being really, really silly, and like it is so easy to die in this game from falling or flinging your spaceship into the sun, like because you have infinite respawns, like they play with that and it can be a little frustrating. But this deep down, like I think they care about the science and like the mechanics of the world. This is actually also a hard space simulator.
Oh.
And basically my moment with the game was just staring into the void of space and realizing how truly insignificant and tiny we are on a cosmic scale.
It's fuck a yeah. fantastic thing for a video game to help you feel, though.
Like,
that's a moment.
Yeah.
That's a moment, but there's more to it. Like, where Aquarium was like the game I cried the most at in like a kind of bittersweet happy way, this one got me to cry from like pure despair and horror.
Yeah.
And just emptiness, I guess I would describe. There's a moment in another moment in this where it felt like this game violated an unspoken rule between developer and player. Where it really, really hurt me.
Oh,
no, I'm not saying that in a bad way. I'm just saying like, oh, wow, you caught me off guard here. Like, I didn't understand the nature of what we were doing here. It's a lot more than I thought, huh?
Oh.
And then the ending of this game goes real hard when you finally figure out, like, I had a general idea the whole time of what. Because, like, the game doesn't tell you what the overall goal to beating it is. It's just...
It just kind of lets you play around.
Yeah.
And it just kind of happens.
Yeah. And another thing that happens is that 22 minutes in, the sun explodes, and you go back to the start, and it says, do it again.
Oh.
It's Majora's Mask all over again.
I forgot about that bit, yeah.
Yeah, so the goal is piecing together the mystery of these aliens on these planets and figuring out what your goal to the end game is. Because there is a way to beat it, obviously, but sure. It doesn't tell you mm-hmm. what you're supposed to be doing. And the ending is pretty insane. Yeah, I just think this is an incredibly unique piece of software.
Yeah,
I haven't played the DLC. I tried to start it and then, like, the ship went the wrong way, and I'm like, oh, this is annoying. I'll come back later. And then I didn't. But I will probably definitely play the DLC next year.
Cool.
That's awesome. This one looks so dope.
Yeah, this, I feel like...
I think you guys would get a kick out of this.
Yeah, despite like the 22-minute thing, which I think would just initially be a thing that is annoying until you understand, like, this is just what this game is doing. This is not like
it's very, very important.
Yeah, it's like it's not a punishment. You're just kind of like you're just figuring things out, and it feels like so long as you just like figure more shit out each time, which it sounds like the game's kind of good at helping you nudge that way. Like this definitely is one that I really feel like I need to get on.
It has a very good like database system of showing you connections between things that you read.
Yeah, even if
you didn't actually read it, like the game thinks you did.
Yeah,
But yeah, you can piece together and kind of feel like what thread seems like I need to pull on it more and maybe investigate a little more. Yeah, it's really neat. I had something on the tip of my tongue. Oh yeah, the one thing is that this game truly demands your full attention because it really doesn't come together until like the last 10%. Because I remember being like pretty far in and being like, I don't know where this is all going. Please, is it?
Please stick the landing.
coming in my mentions, like, trust the process, and they're totally right. Like, when that web coalesces and you see the full picture, you're like, holy fucking shit, man, what? It's all connected. Every single thing. It is like aliens came to your solar system and they built a Rube Goldberg machine that involves like 7 different planets.
Fantastic.
It's crazy.
Yeah. This game has always sounded rad.
So yeah.
I can't wait.
There is a bit of a learning curve to jumping into it because it uses the momentum of your spaceship as like comedy.
Yeah,
but dying it over and over can get frustrating.
Yeah, like it's that. Like I said, it definitely seems to be a game where you need to get over the idea that dying is a punishment.
Yeah,
it's mm-hmm. more of just like this is just part of the process. Just relax mm-hmm. and enjoy yourself.
Yeah, that's my number three.
Awesome.
Good job. Good bad advice.
Got ourselves another listener list.
Yeah.
This one comes in from our loyal dog, Maple. Maple says, here's some games. We start mm-hmm. with Opus Echo of Star Song.
Cool.
This game is legitimately one of the best narrative games I've played this year. The characters are all so good, and the story is very compelling. I cried so hard at the end because it was so good, and have one of the final scenes as my desktop background. That's how good it is.
Mm.
Number two, Beacon Pines. A cute narrative game that has a really neat mechanic and a really good story. Its cutesy art hides its deep story and interesting twists. I like the characters in this game. I think there were a lot of good characters in that game. And three, Homebody. A horror game I've heard no one talk about, but is so good and is so genuinely scary. It's the Groundhog Day of horror games that makes you wonder, what's gonna happen next? And that's that do be Maple's list.
Maple is just like the champion of like cool offbeat Steam games, yeah, specifically.
Like, the things Maple posts links to at times, like they're all just like this. I never would have heard of this otherwise. Like Opus especially is one like that's at the top of the list, and that's obviously the one that I think looks the most interesting as well. Of the ones that I've seen them post. So, yeah, solid. All right, John, it's number three time. You've got to do it.
Well, I got to pull up the list because I need to add to the number here. My number three is Seabed.
Yo, let's go. Hey. That's three, baby.
Yep. No, I think it's
both played this year.
Yeah, we both played it this year.
Yeah.
It's been on my radar for a long time because Cecile loves it. It's been like Cecile, I've been wanting to play it for years.
Yeah, Cecile and Sayara are the two people that championed this game long before we got to it.
Mm-hmm. Oh my god! I think I think Cecile pointed Sayara at it, so like she really did like get this on the community radar. I think.
Yeah.
I mean everything you said, Bobby. I think what I want to add is I fucking love the production in this game because it's so doujin.
Yeah, so. Like it gives an energy the way like that it works with its backgrounds. Its character art is like it's not bad. It's just not like oh you're not like this is not anime studio character sprites. These are
it's
sprites drawn by a dude.
It's the backgrounds are all either edited photos like Higurashi or Blender CGs. They're Blender environments that get passed through a filter. It looks it's so good.
I'm always going to be a big fan of filtered backgrounds for visual novels.
The Blender one was new to me. It looks so cheap. It's great.
Oh, it's great though. It's so good.
There's like a very tactful number of CGs and character art. The character art looks fucking great. I love this artist. He makes such pretty girls.
Oh, the aunt, man. I want to go on a date with the aunt so much.
She's so pretty. These are such pretty girls, Polly.
Yep, they're all gorgeous. Like Dr. Hibiki. She's so gorgeous.
Woman. Woman. Woman.
Need.
Jesus. Yeah, this is the, I think, the longest, like, capital Y Yuri VN I've read. And I think one thing I also want to, I really like the, and also all the music is like public
domain.
Royalty-free music. Fuck yeah. So it's just like, it's this huge script told in a very, basically the least pretentious way possible. That still sings as a VN just because the character art is so gorgeous. One other thing is I think the ending is extremely sweet. I don't want to sell the game to folks as being like a really, really downer.
No,
like
it's not a downer at all. It's a beautiful ending. It's absolutely riveting. It's just, I've never seen this type of story climax that way.
It'd be really good. I remember at one point being like, oh, it's like, and then I named an anime, and then Cecile went, I haven't watched that anime, John. Oops. Just trust me. But yeah, I pulled up my little review. I wrote, Seabed is as affecting a story as any visual novel I've read. I don't have much to say beyond that. That wouldn't spoil the shape of the story, but if you're up for the slowest of slow burns and you appreciate VNs with grown-up theming that don't talk down to you, give this one a read.
Yep. Yeah, like that. I just really appreciated the maturity of the story, and I continually appreciated the prose and the way that it was. Again, it's written not like a light novel. It's not written like a visual novel. It's written like a novel-ass novel, and I really liked that.
Yeah, it's, if there's anything that feels amateurish, it's just that they, you can tell they did not want to cut out anything.
Yeah, yeah, like they wanted everything in there, and sometimes that doesn't always work.
You kind of get it. You kind of get why they, like, you want, the story is shaped like a spiral. You're just going inwards into the center of this relationship.
Yeah.
And every little moment that doesn't seem to really tie with anything, it's all part of that.
It all, so like, beautiful. You look back at those moments that, like, didn't feel like they were doing anything when you get to that climax, and it's all, like, it was all leading to this. Like, you needed those moments for this moment to land, and it's just like, fuck, dude.
Oh, man. When I booted up the game, literally, like, the first 10 minutes was, like, the prose voice is kind of, like, to me, like, some of the best parts of Higurashi, where, like, the kind of the character voice sort of backs off a little bit.
And it's more, and it's authory.
It's very author. It's very authored. I was just reading it like, this is like one of the most gorgeous, like, kinds of prose voices I see in VNs. I was just immediately kind of gripped by it.
Yeah. Like, you could print this off, you could print this script off and just make it a book, and it would be fine.
Yeah. It's really nice when someone close to you points you at a VN and points you at a game, and you get to play it together, and you have a really good time. Made me happy. So yeah, Seabed, absolute turbo banger.
Absolutely.
VNs are fucking great, y'all.
I love me some VNs.
And and I really like it when girls are in love.
It's so sweet, isn't it?
I really like it when women love each other.
God, these two, like, I just keep coming back. Like, even, like, long after I finished this game, I just kept coming back to all their cute little interactions. Like, they are so unbelievably in love with one another. But it's like, again, it's not like these overwrought dramatic declarations of love or anything. They're just they're just doing normal everyday things together, but the way they interact with one another is just so incredibly sweet and believable as two people who are in love.
One of them is like so restrained and kind of withholding with her feelings that it almost seems like she doesn't like the other one.
Yeah, it's,
the longer you luxuriate in the story, you just realize like, oh no, this is that little moment there. That was her expressing her love.
That was her expressing love. Yeah, it's so, man. It's just it digs so well into these characters and how they get expressed and Takako is just. She's loud and fun and expressive, and she just perfectly balances everything out.
It's a new, maybe it's like top two, top three Homer Amaticas of all time.
Yeah. It's good shit.
All right. That's my number three.
Love Seabed. Good one.
Love Seabed.
Ooh, Rhett, listener list time.
I've got one of the longest ones right here.
All right.
Yeah, let's do it.
Getting comfy.
Okay, this comes in from Sylvie. Hi, yay. It's Sylvie. My games of the year are Makai Toshi Saga, Romancing Saga, and Saga Frontier.
Fuck yeah!
All right.
That's it.
Rhett, I'm starting to think Rhett gave himself that one for a reason.
Listen, this one came in well after the deadline. We're in the weeds now.
Yeah, we're in the these are coming in at like 6 and 7 a.m. Eastern time while Rhett's just snoozing along.
Yeah.
That was our next chance to get another Final Fantasy II mention, but unfortunately Sylvie also played 7 Saga games. So.
Jesus Christ.
She played six. She skipped Legend 3. She played 6 Saga games and Final Fantasy 2.
That's insane.
Yeah.
And now she's gonna go riff on those in some really brilliant way that'll make me mad that I didn't think of it.
Yep. Oh yeah, we know it. We all know it.
Oh boy.
Thank you, Sylvie.
Thank you so much, Sylvie. Appreciate the contribution. Oh boy. Guess we are now officially in it, aren't we? Oh my god. Okay, so.
Oh, you told me there was a potential for a flip here.
I'm not kidding when I say this. This is not a bit. Mm-hmm. All the way up until now, this very second, I have not decided my number 2 end game of the year. I have been. Dude, my brain has been deadlocked in this decision for 2 months or more. And every iteration of my list has had 2 games at the top, and there's just never been a clear winner. So I have literally just decided to make the choice live, right here, as we're recording it, and living with it. Once it's done, no do-overs, no take-backsies, whatever comes out of my mouth here, this is it. And like, I want to just make it clear that both games have occupied a very large point of my braining over the last year. Both are games that, like, I actively seeked out so many people to talk about them with because I feel like they're works that are enhanced by engaging with others and hearing their thoughts. Both games had an incredible impact on me this year. Like, one, from the standpoint I guess the enormity of what I feel like it's doing, and the other just hit me in the feels real good. And as you know, around these parts, games always score real well when they make us cry. So I am going to rip the bandage off now.
You still haven't chosen? Oh, you've chosen. You've chosen in your heart. You know. You know what the answer is, Polly. Tell us. Tell us the answer.
I hope you heard the pain in that sigh.
You've already made the decision. You know it. You just need to accept it now.
My number 2. I think that every year there is always a game on my list where I say, this did not snag the number 1. But this is important, and I want everyone to play it. This is a game where, when I saw the trailer, I knew 10 seconds in.
Oh, fuck yeah.
That's my jam. Yeah.
There it is.
My number 2 is 1,000 times Resist.
Oh.
So, What is 1,000 times resist? It is a
best fucking trailer in the world.
It's the best. Like, dude, I'm not even spoiling it. I want you to go look up 1,000 times resist trailer and then just watch the first 10 seconds. You'll know why.
Yeah.
This is a game where I literally only heard about it somehow a month before it came out. I saw the first 10 seconds of their trailer and closed the browser and said, I'm buying your game day one. And I did. And I fucking marathoned this game in a day.
Really?
Yes. 1,000 Resist is a sci-fi narrative focused walking simulator game whose themes largely encompass like immigrant diaspora, generational trauma, and a very, very, very heavy focus on the struggle against depression. I guess the title kind of gives that away. So, to kind of like, I've got to explain this a little, and I'm going to try to not take up a lot of your time. But so the game takes place in a society consisting solely of beings who have been created directly as copies of a figure known as the All Mother. And All Mother herself is an like all-powerful being that this entire futuristic sci-fi society revolves around. All the characters that are born into this world are born as clones of her, and they are just kind of shells. They don't have a color. Like they're it's very, you know, sterile kind of like bodysuit. You're wearing all white. You all look kind of the same. And you may eventually become a shapen sister, someone who has a specific function, like fixer or a healer or something like that. And eventually, these shapen sisters may be called to join All Mother. And this kind of like adds a bit of like of a religious bent to things, too. So the All Mother herself is literally a bratty teenager named Iris. Who is a daughter of two Hong Kong immigrants who escaped to Canada in the 2010s before Hong Kong was absorbed into China in 2047. So this game takes place in roughly 2048-ish.
Mm-hmm.
And Iris became the All Mother because she had an immunity to some kind of weird disease that wiped out humanity during an alien invasion. So the god of your new world is literally an angsty teen. And you primarily play the role of Watcher, a character whose sole purpose is to convene with your sisters and bear direct witness to the memories of the All Mother, which basically just means you relive all of these various points of her life by directly entering her memories and being a part of them. And you go from her teen years during an alien invasion through the events that occur that create the society that you now exist in. And during this, during her first communion, she ends up being hacked and she gains information from an unlikely source that leads her to the fact that this entire society may very well be built on a lie that has persisted for 1,000 years.
Jesus Christ.
So the game then weaves back and forth through Iris's memories and like learning of the kind of person she was and the things she did and the events of the present, where Watcher is faced with a lot of very difficult decisions based on what she knows. And then the fallout of those decisions that she makes that you don't make as the player. The story is the story. This is a game that is just so full of stuff that I can't adequately summarize it. This is a game that is so full of so many moments that I couldn't stop and like name just one. Like there is one chapter in particular that may well be like the most affecting and outright terrifying thing I've ever experienced in interactive fiction. You have to experience it kind of thing. But on top of all that, though, like this is just a remarkably really interesting world full of incredibly well-written characters. And you absolutely want to be running around the home base every chapter and talking to everybody. Because this is that game where interact with everybody because everybody's got a story and it's really good. But this is basically a multi-layered story and it's built for the future. Like, it's a story that deals very specifically with the 2014 and 2019 Hong Kong protests and the repercussions of Hong Kong's absorption into China and what that means for an entire generation of people. It's a story that digs deep and tries to answer the question of, like, how do you teach the next generation about your struggle and what you ultimately fought for and lost without also passing on that trauma? The phrase that keeps coming up in the game is, there is a you that remains and remains and remains. And that just stuck with me. It's like, that's what you're doing. That's what you're you know, like, it's a heavy fucking game. It is tackling so many heavy things, but I think that it does it in a way that is digestible through way of the story that it's telling through its sci-fi setting. Like, it's also very cool. Like, there are also a lot of very cool characters, a lot of great writing. But it's also a story that I think is important because it's very good at making the gravity of the history it's sharing and its rippling repercussions digestible and understanding to a generation that's going to need that understanding. Like, at some point, you know, Hong Kong is going to be absorbed and you have a whole generation of people after that that aren't going to know how to deal with that or understand what all that means. And this is a game that really digs into that shit. But I also, like if I had, I'll wrap up by saying that as silly as this sounds, I think this game's important. I think it's important because of what it's saying and what it's showing. And I think that from a storytelling perspective, it is doing things with an interactive medium that I've not seen anybody handle with such grace and such a honed and perfected pen. Like, it's just an amazing piece of work, top to bottom. And it is, like, the game on my list that I am asking everyone to play. Please play 1,000 times Resist. And I am sorry for talking so long.
God, I play this one. God, I play this too. That fucking trailer, I'm gonna play this one. Yeah. No, this one's been all, it's just nonsense that I haven't played it.
It's a year of, I've been meaning to get to that.
No, sorry. But like, I've been meaning to get to that. Like, I don't know. It would be really funny if I had like a good example, like a funny example right off the cuff, but this is like a, no, seriously. It's like this and Death of a Wish are the, like, no, seriously, John, you gotta get that.
What are you fucking doing?
You clown.
Yeah, I'm sorry for going so long there. That is
It's number two.
That is a game that is so big. Like I said, it's enormous that what it's doing, but I think it is all very digestible. What I said probably sounded like a fucking word salad to most people. But once you play it, I think it will completely click. It's like, oh, no, I get what this is doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, this is very important, I think.
Yeah.
So sorry about that.
Not a problem.
Listener list. John, I do believe you have one from somebody named Cecile.
I haven't looked at this yet. Oh, I just opened it. Yes. Oh, that makes me happy. This is a list from Cecile/Zelaz. Honorable mention goes to Seabed, which I played with John this year. Would easily be in this game to this top three if I hadn't already made it my number one a few years ago. Number three, Love Yourself. Finally, Kaizo for the rest of us. I've had a lot of fun watching John slowly break into Kaizo ROM hacks, but this game showed me that with a little practice, I can enjoy these kinds of games as well. Mm. Oh, it's so nice. Number two, Anthology of a Killer. I haven't had this much fun exploring 3D spaces since my last Super Mario 64 playthrough. Some absolutely inspired 90s-ass visual design paired with wonderfully comedic writing and some unsettling camera tricks make every episode of the series a slightly blood-tinged delight. Mm. Number one, Chorus Gaiden, Priestess of the Forgotten Hero. When I made Daisy Goes to Slime Castle for tea last year, I admit I geared a lot of its content towards things that reminded me of John and things I felt John would be impressed by. I similarly felt like Chorus Gaiden was similarly geared towards my tastes. Hands down, the best erotic writing I've run into a game in this year, combined with emotionally resonant story of self-discovery. I love this entire cast, but I especially love the math nerd spider girl elder god. Thank you. Thank you, Cecile. I love you. I think I felt like I think I felt like there was maybe a little more of a vein in the Sox community of people wanting to read about elf girls dying.
Yeah.
than there actually was.
Maybe a little.
But I got to watch Cecile play it and have this huge fucking grin at her face and have a really, really nice time. So I nice. Still feel real good about it. That's one of my favorite stories I've worked on.
Yeah. I'll get really to it, I promise. It's just the mood's gotta find me.
The mood's gotta find you. The spider girl's really good, Polly.
I'm here for it. Like her. I'm here for it. I'm ready.
Alright, Chorus Gaiden also tied with Final Fantasy VII Rebirth.
I noticed that Anthology of the Killer. Oh,
the
really
Killer is starting to kind of, let's put it, four now?
Uh-huh, it's at three, I think.
At least it's three, yeah.
Because I was the first one to mention it, and then Mealy, I think. And then
gotcha, okay.
Yeah, no, that's ahead of almost all of them.
That's crazy.
That's tied with Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth,
nice.
And East 10.
Yeah, baby!
Fuck yeah. All right.
I've always known when. So, my number two.
Let's do it, Red.
Like Polly, I also have been thinking of flipping my top two.
Oh, yeah!
This actually was number three at the start of the day, but I decided to move it up.
Damn. And then I'm,
sorry, Outer Wilds, you got bumped. We've talked a lot about it. My number two is UFO 50.
Yeah, that's so deserving.
So, God, I don't know. I know we've talked a lot about this one. I have something different to say.
Go for it.
Yeah, because you played it differently. You played the long ones.
Yeah.
It's not even that. I'm not talking about the games at all.
Oh.
But I'm also very tired from talking. I'm like trying to sort my thoughts all out. Right. We've been doing all this right. for like 6 hours.
We've been going.
I can't talk about what I like about UFO 50 without spoilers.
Oh my God. Is it the actual someone actually engaged? Because nobody's fucking talking about it.
I've literally not seen anybody talk about the terminal shit.
About it.
I know Braylift did it because I kind of guided a tiny, tiny bit. Uh-huh. Like, watching their progress. So the thing about UFO 50 is that there's not 50 games. There's 52.
There's 52, yeah. I always kind of thought that was the thing.
So UFO 50 itself is the zero game.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
Because in-universe explanation is that they made 50 games, and then the 51st game they made was the 50-game compilation.
Oh,
I know. It's so simple when you think
right
about it.
Right fucking duh!
Because when you boot the game up, there's the fake hacker BIOS thing.
Yeah, the hacker BIOS shit.
But then when you actually start the game and get to the title screen, UFO 50, copyright
1989. Oh my God. It's that right was made, there.
It was in universe. But then there's an actual 51st game hidden in there. And apparently maybe way too well hidden in there.
Oh.
Because nobody finds it. Nobody talks about it. I believe Toad cherried all 50 games.
And didn't find it?
And I guess they have not found it.
Oh my God.
I feel like they would have mentioned it at this point.
Like, I don't think that... it involves farting around with the terminal, right?
There's a lot of terminal stuff.
Yeah, like, I don't think Toad's been farting with the terminal at all.
It's crazy.
I can't believe this.
They maybe hid this a little too well, but it...
I'm over here, and I was like, this is not greater than the sum of its parts. It is exactly the sum of its parts.
And I'm over here going, here's why UFO 50 is greater than the sum of its parts.
Fuck fucking meta game bullshit.
I love meta game bullshit. I was fucking around with the console while playing Barbuda day one and stumbled into something.
Day one
I was in the 51st game.
Yeah, it was not hard to kind of get into that, like, if you were looking into the right places or looking at the terminal at the right time.
Yeah.
Incredible.
So there was a discussion towards the start when this game came out, like, the developers straight up said, we made 50 games because they couldn't be sold on their own.
Yeah.
And that was like kind of like the side John backed.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then Polly was really impressed by how there's this whole layer of like narrative behind the UFOsoft company and like how all these games are connected. And I am firmly on that side now because of what the 51st game is. And I guess I should just say it. Yeah. Polly, have you played this at all?
I've not done this, no.
Oh, okay. The 51st game is a thing that one of the developers snuck into UFO 50 without the company knowing. It is like an autobiographical tale of what it was like to work at UFOsoft.
Incredible.
It is an airing of dirty laundry for a fictional company.
Yeah!
30 years ago, and it's kind of scathing.
Oh, this is so good!
Because again, it is like a company on the brink of collapse, because apparently, as far as we know, they did collapse immediately after UFO 50.
Yeah.
So this game takes place between the release of Cyber Owls and UFO 50.
UFO 50, yeah.
This was so whoever made Combatants, they're responsible, right?
No.
Oh, okay.
Combatants is like part of the meta narrative story where it is very directly attributed to Tao Nemuru, like the executive lead at the time. God, I'm trying to think of how to order this as logically as possible. Basically,
I can't believe you're really revealing this all to us in real time in the podcast.
No, I'm sorry.
This is great.
I mean, I'm having a ball because we get to react authentically.
It's hard to talk about without spoiling too much. I'll try to show you guys how to get to this later.
Okay.
Fuck. Basically, you know how all the UFO 50 games, or mostly the ones in the middle, they have a very, very light narrative?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you beat the game, you get like two credit screens and then a cute little credit roll.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm just trying to drill down on what the themes of, I think, what this game is trying to say is, like, the credit rolls, they seem really cute and quaint at start, but apparently, like, through the games, they start to change. Like, at a certain point, the executive producer, Tao Nemuru, is, like, the headlining name.
Right.
And, like, giving himself top credit, like, consistently.
That's something you just kind of see that the whole through all of those damn
it's
credit
so
rolls.
It's so fucking subtle. And like, I think like the last three or so games, he's top credit and full name, and everyone else is like just initials.
Yeah, just initials. Yep. Shit.
It's like, it's a scathing critique of this one executive that bought the company at some point.
It's his fault. I told you.
And that's why they made one game in this collection bad on purpose and then blamed it on him.
That's so funny.
So, like, the two, like, meta narratives, I think, or like themes of this game that I think are important are credits in games are important because this game is like showing you in multiple ways, like how the work that these people made was kind of being erased as the company progressed. Mm-hmm. And it's a weird, like, double standard because we don't know for sure which people
Right.
Yeah. Like, it's fucking crazy, right? We don't know who actually made these games specifically.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of talk about, like, the Downwell dude.
Yeah.
The Downwell dude working on this. We think we know which game he made.
Sure.
But I don't think they've actually put that out there.
God, no, that's so weird. I didn't realize that.
And the fact that the game has, like, supporting evidence to, hey, this is kind of fucked up when you start hiding the developers' names is wild.
That's Oh my god.
And I think a weird fucking thing. What a weird thing to exist.
Seeing people, like, I've seen, like, the fan wikis try to associate who made each game.
Who made what? Yeah.
And I think the fact that, like, people are trying their best to figure out who should be credited for each game is further validation of its themes.
Because
it's making people care about who created these games.
Yep, absolutely.
And I think that's really fucking clever.
Oh man, UFO 50 is pretty fucking rad, dude.
It's really. This is why it almost was my number one, because I think in terms of how this meta narrative tied together and made me emotional was really caught me the fuck off guard.
Yeah, like this is something that has become a major thing in the AAA space these days, of when people leave companies before a game ships, or like in the last month or so, they just get their credit removed, like for no fucking reason.
Oh yeah, they're so bad
it's
about
been,
that.
It's been true forever. Ugh.
Where they just list everybody that currently works there, not who actually worked on.
Of course, like all of the shit that happened back in the day, and like when people would only be credited with just pseudonyms,
the whole pseudonym era,
and that was done to quote unquote prevent headhunting of talent, but it also just strips people of credit. It also just keeps them it might serve one function. But it's also, you're very obviously also doing this so that they can't just go do something else.
Yeah. Yeah, so the last few games in this having only initials for credits is like a callback to that really shitty practice.
Yep.
Of trying to hide who made these games. Like you can only figure out who did it because of all the other games, like the same names keep showing up.
Yeah,
over
the
and
same
over.
Names keep showing up. I think you could probably even tie it to shit like similar sound effects being used and shit.
Yeah,
or yeah, things like that.
Yeah, because all of those developers are characters in the last game that you get to talk to.
Really cool.
And it's all very like cutesy characters of like animals and stuff. But I think like. People have tried to draw like connections to like real world equivalents, like, oh, this guy is, you know.
Oh, God.
And I don't think those line up at all.
No,
that seems like a stretch.
Yeah.
That's beginner's guiding.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, God.
The other major theme that really hit for me, and I'll try to wrap this up, is that the in-universe explanation for this, like, ignore the meta stuff. Say this was all real, that this company existed in the late 80s, released 50 games, and then everybody forgot about them. Mm-hmm. That's fucking tragic.
It really is.
Like, the idea of, like, games from that era just being erased from history.
But there are a lot of games from that era that likely aren't preserved.
For real, it definitely happened, and that sucks.
Yeah.
So, like, the in-universe of, like, this is about games preservation. I'll just say it.
Sure.
Like the idea that they found this thing and spent like 6 years, the actual dev time, restoring it to get it to run on PC and Steam.
Oh.
Extremely admirable.
Yeah.
Like, cause they said, hey, these games should be seen and played. The world should know about them.
Yep.
Cause otherwise this company just never everyone existed. Forgot.
Yep. That's cool as fuck.
That's yeah. Really so cute. It's a game to me. It's a game about credits and preservation.
Yep.
It's not number one because maybe I don't love all 50 games and I haven't gone around to like 30 of them at least.
Get out of here, Bug Hunt.
I'm going to stand Bug Hunter on this podcast. I'm the one who fucking likes Bug Hunter.
Soxcast approved.
Here's what I did. Here's what I fucking did. I was on the third round, the one you need to get the clear. And then I was looking at everything in the shop and I realized, wait a minute. There's an item that specifically damages characters that are raised up in the that are like on the either in the ground or up raised up in the air, I think. And I got an item that can specifically like invert a specific tile. And I've got an item that inverts the raising and lowering of every tile on the board. I moved my character to up one tile, inverted one of the monsters. Inverted every single tile in the game and then made all like 15 or 16 bugs that were still alive and about to kill me explode at once.
That's fucking crazy.
And then I won. It felt so good.
Beautiful. I definitely do like a lot of the games. Warp Tank and Porgy were kind of my early jams.
Warp Tank is really fun. That's one I want to get back to. I played a little bit of it, and I know that, like, yeah, I want to play that a lot.
Yeah, I played a lot of the 5 to 6 hour games. I still have not finished Grimstone.
Yeah.
It's so much harder than I thought it was going to be. I did, like, the Tower of Four Fiends last night, and I'm just like, this really isn't the end. There seem to be at least 2 more dungeons left. I'm like, okay, guys.
Insane.
Yeah, I think that game
How is Grimstone?
It's fine. It's very grindy.
Okay.
Yeah, it's... They lean into that. It's grindy.
I was curious what an RPG in the game collection that where the games don't have stories.
There's how that lands. The tracest amount of story. It's just more... cool vibes. It's
all right.
Western hell.
Hey, that ain't nothing. I think the story that made me smile the most was Magic Garden and then Camouflage.
Yeah.
Camouflage is super cute.
Waldorf's ending is very funny. Waldorf's ending is good.
Get 50 shells for the true ending.
Okay, except for that part. Except fuck that. UFO 50. We're going to be pecking at that for a while.
That's the thing. I was like... I originally was like not even sure this was going to be on my list at all because I wasn't like going to finish it until next year. And then I hit the like what I would consider the end game. And I was like, OK, got to be here.
Cool. Fucking cool.
Because remember when I asked what games have skeletons? That was me doing the metagame.
Rhett, I can't believe you took UFO 50, the collection of 50 tiny games, and then managed to turn it into a Rhett game. Fuck.
Insane. You managed to turn it into
like, oh yeah, then you cry at the end game.
Of course.
Props. Insane.
Okay, Polly.
Yo.
One more.
We have one more listener list, our final listener list. This one comes in from our good pal Jessica, who, despite the fact that she's been going through a lot lately, and much love to her for that, she was still able to get us just a small list of games that she played and enjoyed this year. And I realized I never got around to writing one with everything that's been going on. I hadn't played very much recently, but let's go with Final Fantasy IV.
Yeah!
Power Rangers, Rita's Rewind, and Metal Gear Solid 2.
Nice. Badass.
Hopefully next year I'll be in a better spot to send another audio list. Hell yeah, Jessica, your audio lists always were a delight. So hopefully,
yeah,
we're pulling for you. Hopefully you're in a much better place. Love you lots.
Love you lots, Jess.
All right, John, we've done it.
Want my number two?
We need your number two. Let's go.
Well, this one's, I told you this is the year of the anthology game, right?
Absolutely.
This one's a little different because it's basically like one big story, but split up into 8 different chapters. Mm. You could say it's a story of magic and romance and betrayal. It's a story about men, a man being really violently cucked. I think there's only one game it could be. Polly, I think you know what it is.
What do you think? No, go ahead. I'm not taking your thunder.
All right, okay. Well, my number two is obviously Live Alive.
Yeah. Yeah. Kind of. I that was either going to be number two or one. That one just... Yeah.
Well, yeah, there's obviously nothing else it could be.
No, nothing else at all.
Shit. Stupid, because it's not even 8 chapters. this game's as good as it gets, huh?
That's what I hear. Like this
is my take.
This is like one I really need to get on. And it's just like this has been available and translated for so long. It's kind of stupid that I have not touched this.
I posted under your Mal account when I was 16 that I'd started Live Alive.
That you'd started this, right? Oh my god.
I didn't
god.
Get far into it, but I was like, this seems really cool. And then I was like, I should get back to that someday. Well, it's fucking 14 years later.
14 years later.
I got back to it.
You played the original version too, not the the remake or remaster.
You know, I played the fan translated Super Famicom. It's a great fan translation.
Yeah, it's a really good fan translation. Actually,
in what universe would I play any other version? it's like Chrono Trigger or the Final Fantasies, where it's completely together and tight in its original incarnation. It runs at a perfectly good clip. It's drop dead gorgeous. This was like the last hurrah of 16x16 pixel character sprites in Square RPGs, and it is beautiful. This came out after Final Fantasy VI, but it's a game that it's like post FF6, but we're still making games that look kind of like FF4 and 5, and it's the most beautiful incarnation of that. The fucking colors in this game are just off the charts. I was constantly stopping and looking at the pixel art.
Yeah. I love how vivid the palette in this game
is. It's so vivid. So the big draw here is that this is basically seven different micro RPGs. They are of varying lengths. Some are like 20 minutes, some are like 3 hours. And they're fucking stunning. There's a fighting game chapter where you just fight seven bosses in a row. there's an adventure horror game chapter where there's like one fight in the whole chapter. There's a Western chapter, Grimstone reference.
Nice.
Where you have to like lay traps and like move through a town to collect resources on a timer. Mm-hmm. It's so fucking cool.
There's a mecha chapter. Everyone just does its own unique little thing.
I was kept waiting to be like, okay, that was the banger. I played like my three I was most excited about and expected the rest to kind of be like, okay, and now we're kind of moving through the filler before we get to the finale. I just loved every chapter. I loved every chapter in this game. They were all bangers. The caveman chapter, there's no dialogue. It's all like fun emoting. They get across an entire story just with like the character, the 16x16 pixel sprites emoting.
That's great.
It's incredible. There's wild swings and turns mid chapters with like character deaths, and like they just go real hard with it. And every single chapter ends with them playing. Every song is different. Every chapter is different battle themes, but then they have the same end of chapter battle boss theme with Megalomania.
Yeah.
So it's just like, every single time that song plays and you go into the climactic conversation, it's a kind of RPG high I can't really place in anything else, where it's just like, it's a game that hits like final boss level intensity over and over and over again.
Yeah.
The battle theme is cute as can be. It's just very, it's very mathy.
It's so like, mathy. It's one of the most mathy video game tunes I've ever heard.
You try to solve the fights. You're given a handful of tools and you figure out what the right approach is. And then, so like, if it was just seven amazing like micro RPGs, I would have been completely happy. The eighth chapter that unlocks after the other seven is off the rails incredible. It knocked me on my ass in a way I completely did not expect.
It's one of those like, wow, I see why this is such a constant touchstone for Iffy, huh?
Uh-huh. And then the final chapter after that is just like, it's kind of like the story steps back a bit so you can play with all the tool toys they've introduced.
Yeah.
Like it's the game like kind of fulfilling all of its promises as an RPG. Mm-hmm. And the finale fucking rules. It fucking rules. Credit where it's due, the remake adds a new final boss phase, and I looked it up, and it's actually pretty fucking dope.
I think it sounds like they did really well on that remake. It sounds real classy.
Yeah,
it sounds classy as shit. Very much in the same vein of the Saga Frontier where Kawazu was literally there to help add back in the things that he was not able to in that original version. So, like, man, Square has kind of been on a roll with some shit, despite You know,
sounds like the DQ3 one is good.
Yeah. Yeah. DQ3 sounds incredible. Mm-hmm. So,
but again, like when it's a 90s, like I get it when you don't want to play NES Dragon Quest.
Yeah, for like, sure.
That makes sense to me. I played the SNES and GBC Game Boy Color versions because I was like, I'm not hardcore enough for this yet.
Mm-hmm.
But 1994 Super Nintendo Square,
just
it doesn't
on
need,
a level.
You don't need that digested for you. You can just jump in and have a blast. And I don't. To me, this original version is fucking perfect.
Yeah.
The one of the things I came away from it from was just like there's stuff I've seen in friend RPG Maker games or in my own RPG Maker games and thought, oh my goodness, I'm so original. We're such geniuses. I love us so much. And then Live Alive did the same thing tonight in 1994.
It's like that episode of South Park. Simpsons did it. Live Alive did it.
Which isn't discouraging because it's like,
no, because you're just, that just means you're as much of a brain genius as they are.
Yeah, we're part of an ongoing dialogue that's been going on for 3 decades.
Like genius recognized genius.
RPGs are fucking cool as hell. I love RPGs. I love playing, making them. I love playing them. My friends' games. It's just a blast, and they've always been experimental. They've always been weird, and they've always been interesting. Like, I think this game absolutely stands toe to toe. If you're a genre pervert, I think that this is easily like as good as any of as cool as any of Square's other games on the SNES.
Yeah, for sure.
It's also absolutely. They do a lot of stuff in this game that they kind of revisit in Chrono Trigger. I think they kind of are both going at being like sort of episodic RPGs in different ways.
Hmm.
Episodic kind of genre hopping RPGs, but in different ways. Where Crunter has a little more of a fiction,
around
it.
Yeah,
but I think they get you to similar places. So fucking love Live Alive. If you've been waiting 14 years to play it,
just go do it.
It's another all timer Square classic.
It's on my Raspberry Pi. It's loaded up. It's ready to go.
Fuck yeah.
I will try and get to that very soon, actually. Because, again, that one's been on my list for so damn long.
It's me, but Thousand Resist. I'm just like, I gotta play that one. I can't wait 14 years to play a Thousand Resist.
No, that would be kind of crappy if you waited 14 years to play a Thousand Times Resist.
I need to play that before Hong Kong gets absorbed into China.
Yeah. Maybe a little more prescient. All right, so before we dive into our personal games of the year, I think it is time to maybe take a moment to recognize the games that unfortunately came up just a little short. I can start things off by giving you a quick list. I won't spend too long. We've been here a while. everybody's tired. but my honorable mentions go Zap and Dash, Super Mario Brothers 1 Celeste.
Nice.
Fantastic hack. It's based on Super Mario Brothers 1 for some reason. You figured they'd use a more advanced engine, but they used 1 and they fucking cooked and made a great game.
There's an SMW one too. Maybe they wanted to experiment with kind of the different approaches.
I think I like this one more.
Cool.
All right, Lily's Night Off. This was just a very funny visual novel by Cupin, who is a friend of mine. About an idol girl, and you end up in just all sorts of very silly situations with her. It is legitimately some of the funniest visual novel writing I've read. Like, just a great command of humor. A fantastic presentation. Narcissu Side Second. This is the second.
Fuck yeah.
Cool. I cried a lot. Fantastic. Thanks for that. Up next, I discovered a new developer this year on Itch and enjoyed every single game from them I played. They're named Nth Circle. I played Of the Devil Episode 0, Model Employee, and Maoshin Line.
How is Model Employee?
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah,
is fantastic. I did an LP of that one too.
Oh, killer.
The only one I haven't gotten to yet in video form is Maoshin Line. So, I also was really a big fan of the demo I played for This Magical Girl is a Bitch. it's so genuinely funny and charming. Steins Gate, My Lover's Embrace, was a fantastic set of love stories set in the Steins Gate universe that legitimately, like, made me feel a lot of things. I just love those characters. And finally, one that I played for about 3 months at work with my Switch, taking it with me, I finished Undernaut's Labyrinth of Yomi, which is a fantastic first-person dungeon crawler that I think would work really well for people if they want to get into this genre, because it's very much in the same vein of Labyrinth of Toho, where you can kind of just respec your shit, like, in the field anytime you want. So you're not making hard decisions that you need to worry about. If you want to invest in these skills and try them out, just do it. It's got a great horror story aesthetic going to it. Just genuinely dark, ugly, and violent. Just great little game that just barely missed my list. But yeah.
Cool. Cool as hell.
Rhett.
John.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Rhett, remember Carrion?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Yeah. Rules. Yeah, Carrion.
This is like, cool. This is like a perfect little package. This is my only Allosoft playing a game, but I played Toshin Toshi, one of the early 90s games. It's just cute as hell.
Oh.
I really like Toshin Toshi. It's the one where you compete in a tournament, and everybody who competes in the tournament has to bring a cute female partner, and then if you win, then you fuck their partner. It's very good. Ballad of Swishy. This is Wuzzy's new game. It's part of the Vextro jam.
Right.
Fucking rules. It's so good. It's not out yet. Sorry. we're kind of taking our time with this one. It's probably coming out in January. The whole complexion as a whole, Wuzzy's game is done. But yeah, Romancing Saga 1. I played this game on hardware for the first 20 hours. It is a fucking weirdo. It is a weird fucking, it is like grinding the game, and it's just like a continuous stream of like number go up endorphins while you explore this freeform world where all of the story threads are like half finished. it is a next level experience. It's very, I love Romancing Saga 2 to bits. Romancing Saga 1 feels like whatever is in Romancing Saga 2 and Saga Frontier in its like rawest, most elemental state. It's very cool.
Nice.
I definitely played it with fast forward for the last 10 hours. Batman on NES, fucking classic. I played like 70 Domino Club games. I'm still just chewing away at all of them as they come out. It's so fun. 20 Small Mazes is a banger.
Mm-hmm. That's really cute.
Yep. I'm going to give my Coruscant. I'm actually give this to Starcross Bloodline to shit.
What's the RPG? I like that one a lot.
Starcross Bloodlines and the Sword of Judgment.
God, that one's so cute.
Yep. I really liked Berserker Knight and the Dragon Lord's Treasure Horde, the chorus to the extremely big
God
chorus to action platformer the top made. It's so fucking huge.
I watched Poncho play that whole thing and it was a delight.
It's so cool. It's very fun. It's so like I think the compactness of Starcross Bloodlines helped it really land for me.
Yeah, for sure.
But I was very honored to contribute to the chorus universe this week. And also pushed the number of chorus games up to
seven. Yeah, seven. Jesus Christ.
Wow.
Got a lot of fucking chorus games. It's great. Those are my honorable mentions.
Rhett.
Oh my God, I can't remember 7 hours ago. I mentioned at the start that I had a list of 12 games.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Number 12, Death's Gambit Afterlife.
Oh yeah.
Oh, cool.
This is a Souls-inspired Metroidvania. The original version, Death's Gambit, was much more leaning towards playing like a 2D Dark Souls.
Yeah.
And then they went and revamped the whole game. They added more areas. They kind of expanded things. They added like more Metroidvania type abilities like a double jump and stuff to kind of make the progression a little smoother. I had a whole damn arc with this game.
Yeah, you did.
In the Afterlife expansion, they also added two new endings. Like there's kind of the standard ending and then there's like the A path and the B path.
Mm-hmm.
And the game tracks like has a like a counter for like deaths and other various things can affect this number. And I was 1 point away from getting the good ending.
Oh, no.
So I had to get the B ending. which has its own like unique final dungeon and last boss. And I was just so frustrated with the game. Not frustrated, but just like refusal to let it win.
Yeah.
That I played the whole thing again from scratch.
You went poly mode on that shit.
I went poly mode because when I tried to do New Game Plus, it was clear that the game had gotten too hard for me.
Yeah.
To actually beat it a second time, because New Game Plus was no fucking joke. So I just started over with the new character. I didn't play a mage the second time. I played a melee character, and I got that goddamn true ending.
Beautiful.
And it's funny because then there's also like some meta narrative stuff about looping the game being a time loop that the characters are stuck in. And I'm just like, oh, okay, this is appropriate, huh? And then I went on the path to find like the super secret hidden boss that involves like some weird fucked up map stuff that I haven't seen since Yume Nikki. It's just like, oh, this is such a weird passion project. I feel it, but the part where you play it just barely kept it off the list.
Which game again?
Death's Gambit Afterlife.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
So yeah, of all the like the games I floated cutting from the list, this one felt the least pain. So it ended up at number 12. And my number 11, this one hurt a lot because it was a shoo-in to be on the list all year until it wasn't.
Oh.
My number 11 is Animal Well. No one fucking mentioned this.
Oh, man. I legit thought this was making the climb.
Absolute. Oh, you thought this was my number one?
I thought this was going to make the... This was a game that felt so huge. And it's just like, well, I've not heard it. Like, did it really
it's another
land
fucking
this
big
well?
Meta puzzle game. It's another fucking post-game meta puzzle.
Oh my god, this game goes too hard with how crazy it gets at the end.
It's oh like, my god, it's I want to play it because it's the art is like it reminds me of like early
beautiful
pre-war games, but like way punched up. It's insane.
It's also like 13 megs, like they're doing some insane compression stuff on it.
Oh,
where it's like it's genuine raw pixel like yeah. compression, like with no bullshit, but it's also very pretty at the same time.
Oh, it's a pretty fucking game. I played like an hour of it and I was just like, man, this is stunning.
I was about to say, I was also mad that Polly like got high on the title screen and never played it. But if you
played
it, no,
I played it for an hour while high, and then I just never got back to it. But I am going to get back to it because I did like what I played.
It's very pretty.
It's very cool.
I want to play the main game at least.
Yeah, the main.
I'm just playing the main game. That whole post game shit seems a little rich for my blood.
It got too crazy too quickly, but I tried to do the, like the first two endings and then was like, okay, I'm good. Cause like at a support point, you can't progress solo. Cause there's a community puzzle. That's like a 51 person thing. Where I'm just like, okay, you went nuts with this.
Yeah.
I think this was always like right next to Tunic on my list, but Tunic, I forgot to mention, had an issue where it can kind of too forcefully point you towards where a puzzle is. Oh. So once you know where the puzzle is, it's a little trivial. Animal Well has the opposite problem where it will not guide you whatsoever.
Yeah.
Okay. And getting like all 52 or whatever number eggs, maybe it's 64, getting all the eggs for the second ending became extremely tedious by the end where it's just like they could be anywhere in the entire world.
Yeah.
So it's like you just look up the last three in a guide. You go, okay, I've had enough of this. I've spent like 80% of my playtime after beating it.
Yeah.
It's got a lot of really cool ideas. It maybe run its course. The more you play it, like it was definitely a case of diminishing returns, I guess.
What happened to video games getting to the credits and then they fucking end?
Yeah.
And then you're done.
What happened? Everything's gotta be meta now.
It's not that this one is really meta. It's that there's puzzles and then there's harder puzzles and then there's really, really hard puzzles. Like, I appreciate them. This game kind of seems to have coined a new term of layers.
Yeah.
Where, like, layer one is just beat the game. Layer two is get all 64 eggs. Layer three is where you start getting crazy. And then layer four, I'm not even going to tell you what you're actually trying to collect in that one. It's, I think compared to like Tunic or even like Fez, this one is the most consistent in it's always about puzzles. because Fez, you know, starts as a rotation game, mm-hmm. and then it becomes something else. Tunic is an action game, and then it becomes something else. This one is always a puzzle game. It just gets really goddamn crazy. Also, it has a problem where some of the new tools that you get are things that you can use on every screen in the game.
Oh, and once right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
once you've done that like two or three 20, times, I'm just like...
Yeah, like, do it 27 like, more. It's like, no, thank you.
I'm just like, no, fuck off. Yeah, I'm done.
I'm out.
But I really like this. I'm a little sad that I realized just now, no one mentioned it.
Oh, it got bloop, nothing, bloop, dude.
Bloop, bloop, bloop.
Womp, womp.
Okay, that's right. My two.
Is that it? Are we done? Is this... Are we ready? Are we in?
Let's get in there.
All right.
In there like swimwear.
We are in the end zone, everybody. We are spiking. We are each going to take a turn spiking the football to indicate our game of 2024. And I guess it falls mm-hmm. on my shoulders to get us started. So here we go. I don't think that my number one is going to be much of a shock to anybody at this point because uh-huh. I
zone out completely. I forget every game y'all play for the entire year, and yeah. every single one of them hits me as a surprise. It's
is that
great.
Right? Really? I don't know how that could happen, given the
God's honest truth. I don't know what you're about to say.
This is honestly shocking to me then, because
I'm going to recognize it, and then I'll go, oh.
I feel like this is something that I've pretty consistently talked about all year. My game of the year, and I'm going to, you know what? Like, John's gotten to cheat this whole time, like, but said, I'm going to do, here's my collection of 90 games for this entry. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to get to do mine. Mine is a collection of 4 games. My mm-hmm. game of 2024 is the Flowers visual novel series.
Yep.
Remember how John said Yuri with a capital Y earlier? Kind of angry that I didn't think of that. I was like, do you really have Yuri with a capital Y, John? To be fair, the Yuri in Seabed is pretty Yuri with a capital
it's
Y.
It's very Yuri.
Flowers is a Yuri visual novel saga. It is what I have come to call the Trails in the Sky of Yuri visual novels, because I feel like this series approaches its world building in a lot of similar ways. It is very similarly structured. It is similarly paced. And it spends a lot of time really digging into its characters in ways that see them all like starting at one point and ending up at another through the natural progression of that only... through the things that they experience in the story, but through how they've grown with others. It's again, Yuri with a capital Y. This is a story that I went into because I was literally just recommended it to somebody. And it's just like, here's this Yuri visual novel series that I'm going to recommend you to read. It's 4 games. It's like, are you insane? You know what you're asking me to do right now? And it's just like, knowing that, like, I already kind of have an aversion to really saccharine, sweet, idealized Yuri. It doesn't land with me. And the thing is that I think that if you look at Flowers in screenshots, if you look at its very wispy presentation, it's very light, it's very airy. And even the story starts rather unassuming, like it's just going to be that like flavor of Yuri that I'm just not a fan of. And then by the back half of the first volume, things start kind of breaking in ways that lead to some real, like, substantive conflicts, mysteries, and motivations begin to get introduced that are going to play central roles in the narrative for the remaining volumes. And every volume, like, what I think is really awesome about this series is that every volume obviously continues the path of this story. It is a story that takes place over 4 seasons. These games take place back to back to back, like literally picking up sometimes moments where the previous game left off. But every volume continues down the path of like unraveling and directly confronting the things the first game sets up. But it does so with every volume of the series being a different kind of story and employing different voices and storytelling techniques. So every volume of Flowers isn't just this one thing that you get in the first volume. So, like, the first volume is, like, the fish out of water story. It is a shy girl learning to be social for the first time, overcoming trauma that she has experienced as a young girl from a stepmother who's treated her terribly. And then the second volume is the actual romance, where two characters are set on a crash course with one another. And that is literally one of my favorite romance stories ever. It's really good. The third game is a psychoanalysis of characters who desperately need to be seen for who they really are, but for various reasons, they wear masks to protect themselves, or to bear guilt they can't let go of, or to live up to status quos that are projected upon them. And then the final volume puts the mystery that's been at the core of the series since the end of the first volume to bed. And it solidifies all of that in ways in which all of these teenagers begin to sort of mature into adults. And I think that that's something that I liked and I enjoyed about Flowers a lot, is it is very much a story about teenagers. And it's a story that writes them very much as teenagers. Like, they... Suo is a goddamn wreck of social anxiety. Erica and Chidori are fucking edgy, angsty teenagers who need to get over themselves a little bit. And they run the gamut of a lot of archetypes, but ultimately, like, it comes down to there is no manual for growing up. There is no manual for teenagers to know how to deal with very big feelings. Or very big decisions that are thrust upon them. And maybe they don't make the best decision. Maybe they end up doing something that inadvertently is cruel or hurts somebody. And this isn't a story that, like, makes... That like, sets impossible standards for children and the teenagers to live up to. It, like, it's a story that tries to look at things through the lens of understanding. Like, why did this character do this shitty thing? It's like, well, there's something here that we do not understand about her. What if you came to understand her more? And the series plays on that a lot. The series is also very deeply in love with literature and cinema. But boy, it wears that shit on its sleeve and is with as believable as it can be with, like, 14 to 15 year olds quoting and philosophizing about fucking Anne of Green Gables or the Maltese Falcon. But what I think could be something annoying and be seen as Family Guy-ish, and that clearly, like, all of these are from the author. The author is in love with these pieces of literature and film, is I think that this, like, the writer deeply understands why those stories work, because this is a story that actually borrows a lot of those storytelling techniques and layers, and it drapes them over its own story, and the references and stuff just never feel like, oh, we're Family Guy in it. Mm-hmm. So for me, I guess it's just Flowers isn't so much about, like, the bigger picture and, like, this large looming mystery. Like, I don't even think that the mystery has, like, a satisfying conclusion. I think that it's more about the characters than anything. And you spend so much time with these characters and in their heads that even if the mystery part doesn't quite hold water, like, there's still a lot there for your brain to gnaw around on. It's a story I still think about. It's a story that I still enjoy discussing with people. There's an unbelievable amount of layering to everything that this story is doing. And the ways that I've been able to dissect it on my own and dissect it with other people. And just kind of seeing, like, the layers to which the writers put things in this story that, like, tie back and layer in on themes or follow up on other things, or it's been kind of an incredible ride. Like, continuing to discover Flowers, despite the fact that I finished it And then I read the second, third, and fourth volumes again. I read the last three volumes twice. So even if you don't dig in to this series, and it's fantastic use of like foreshadowing, theming, literary and cinematic storytelling tricks, there's like a really warm heart at the center, and lots of great stories about relationships and friendships and understanding. These characters are like my precious babies. I love how each and every one of them, by the end of this story, like, it's not a story that just ends with everybody figuring everything out. Like, these characters, this is their first year of high school. You end at their first year of high school, but at the end, you're just like, yeah, I think the kids are going to be all right. They're going to stumble through some shit, but they got each other, and that's all that matters. Just a really mature...
This sounds real nice, Polly.
It's really nice. It's you know, it's got lots of eating scenes. I know you like those.
I didn't even hate
the eating scenes. I think that, like, this series has a reverence for food that is actually really incredible. Like, there's... I can't sit here and go over everything because this is, again, this is much like A Thousand Times Resist. There are so many things I love about this story. Mm-hmm. You know, there are many ways that it touched me. There are many times that, like, I was left just completely sobbing and this is on tape. Like, I let's played this entire damn series. Right. So if you want to, like, hear somebody bawl like a goddamn idiot at, like, you know, the right thing being said or just a touching moment in the series, it's all there. Like, it's all in Technicolor, baby. Flowers is an incredible little capital Y Yuri visual novel experience. And it's just a story that I'm so glad that I discovered. I'm so glad that I discovered so many people who enjoy talking about it and enjoy analyzing it in that same way. And that has added so much to my enjoyment of the series, is being able to share that experience with others and talk about it. It's the same with A Thousand Times Resist. Like, they're both stories that I think get to the top of my list because of like the sense of community I was able to establish by talking to people about them and seeing what other people thought and how they made them feel and what they pulled from it. And I think my view of both stories only got bigger and more enriched for that experience. And I am done talking.
This sounds fucking magical, Polly. This sounds really, really good.
Yeah.
It's really nice when the VN hits just right, huh?
It really is. It's just very funny that it was recommended to me. It's just very funny that it was recommended to me by somebody I no longer date or talk to.
So it goes. We've all been there.
Rhett, talk.
Oh, okay. I forgot we weren't going to do like the recap before our number ones.
Yeah, I want to talk as little as possible from this point forward.
No, we're going to do the recap. We'll do it after.
We'll do it right at the end.
Yeah. But basically there's been a trend, and I didn't do it on purpose with my list, that there's been no sequels thus far.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of like fresh new art things. Even like Gal Guardians is not doing the same thing Gal Gun does. Like, it's a new perspective. Grand Blue Fantasy is not the action. It's an action RPG as opposed to like the phone game. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of new things is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
For my number one, it's time to break that trend.
All right.
Number one is Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree.
Why not, baby? Let's go. I knew it had to appear at some point. Because I knew you liked that shit way more than, I wasn't
this
sure.
This is how I already got.
My game of the year is not a game, it's a DLC.
It's a DLC!
Stunning.
So, it's February 2022. I played two games that month. Cold Steel 2 and Elden Ring. And I think, God, this is a really tough call for game of the year already.
Good Lord, yeah.
Then later in that year, I played Cold Steel 4 and was like, okay, I think the Cold Steel quadrilogy is going to take it. Mm-hmm. It took the weight of four Cold Steel games to push Elden Ring down from the number one spot.
That's nuts,
so
dude.
Now it has gotten its dues by being this year's game of the year, where Elden Ring Shadow of the Erdtree, or as I like to call it, Elden Ring 2.
Elden Ring
and it's
2.
And it's really funny that like 2 days before we recorded this, they just went and fucking announced Elden Ring 3.
Isn't that like, isn't that just like a,
battle map? Yeah, but it's funny to call it that. It's a three-player standalone game. It's also got like the three theming. Yeah. Let me have this one.
I'll let you have it. It's your game it's of the year. Funny. I'm not going to take it.
I was already calling this Elden Ring 2, and then they announced a 3 thing that caught everyone Elden off Ring. Guard. What was that?
Elden Ring. Elden Thring.
Oh, my God. Okay.
You're
okay.
Welcome. Dude, it's 9 o'clock, okay?
What I know. So, the funny thing is, I also wasn't sure if I was going to buy this to begin with, because Elden Ring is a game I spent over 100 hours in. It's a very, very long Souls game. I am very thorough with those games. I explored the map as far as I could to 100% it. I thought I was done. So in the run-up to this, I was like starting to break, like, oh, maybe I am going to get this. These trailers are really fucking cool looking. I started a new character in Elden Ring. I got a scythe. And then I got a second scythe, and I'm running around dual wielding scythes, which is extremely goofy. And then it's been like a few days, and I've got like 20 hours on this character, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm just playing this game again, huh? I think I'm good for the DLC. So, kind of, the DLC takes place like basically right at the end of the main game. Mm-hmm. So you just go in with your character from that beat the game previously, because it's the one, luckily they don't shunt you into New Game Plus.
Right.
So, and I finally got to use this, you know how Souls has like the boss Souls things where like you get a weapon from killing the bosses.
Yeah.
There's the one from the final boss. And it's like, well, I'm never going to use this because I just beat the game. You dummies.
The game, yeah.
So finally, I got to take that soul and make it into a sword that shoots like a gigantic golden laser. And I use that for most of the DLC.
Incredible.
I had a moment while playing this game, and I'm trying to wrap it up already because we're going a little late. I had a moment playing this where I was like, I just felt something wash over me. And that was that. This was the most fun I've ever had playing a video game.
Holy shit.
Oh my, that, yeah. How do you not give that game a year? I really liked that one.
And like, I realized like even immediately in the moment that that was being a little hyperbolic, but it just stuck with me.
But it, like, if that's what you feel, and that, again, yeah, that feeling sticks, like that's, yeah, that's, you know, that's the real shit.
And it's funny because it was just in a totally random moment where I'm just riding the horse around exploring. And I think the world map in this one is actually what pushes it over for me, where it's like basically they took the insane expanse of Elden Ring and crushed it down a little bit to be a much denser world map. Mm-hmm. And then they pancaked it where there's like three or four layers of verticality on top of each other. It does like the Dark Souls thing of being like an extremely vertical map as well in an open world game.
Yeah.
It's just, the design is crazy. It's so cool. And like, it's just still the master of, see that place over there? You can get there.
God. Like, that is a feeling I never get over. Like, I think that people, yeah, like, that's become like a line of like,
just, I know, it's a mockery.
Yeah, to make fun of shit. But like, to me, like, I am still that person that loves that shit.
Yeah, I still love that. And this one, continuously, eventually I started to realize that I was like, underestimating it at every step of the turn, every step of the way, where I would go, oh, that's a really cool looking area over there. It's not playable then. It's just a cool, pretty,
an hour later.
It's just a cool, pretty background. And then I look over and I see a path leading down there. I go, oh, okay. And then I see those mountains over there. That's a really cool mountain range. Oh, you get to go there. Weird. What the hell? Like, I kept underestimating
it. What are video games? How is this possible?
Like, the fact that this is a air quote DLC that's like significantly bigger than most of the regular Souls games. Like, it's definitely bigger than Dark Souls 1. Like, in terms of like how many bosses are the world map. Like, the world map is obviously just way bigger because it is more spread out. You got the horse and all. But then there's like also like 10 major bosses and like a shitload of just side dungeons and mini bosses. The one flaw is the main bosses, they go so insane. I'm sure 90% of the discourse around this was that it gets too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But I still had a good time just summoning and enjoying the spectacle of, you know, lightning beam shooting gods of destruction that are just like really, really ridiculous if you're trying to solo things. But the last boss is also a little overtuned. Eventually I figured out, like, okay, if you just put every stat possible into blocking with the shield, you'll be able to just barely block like his 8-hit combo and then be able to counter once and then rinse repeat. But it's just like, okay, I'm gonna get the heaviest shield in the game, the heaviest armor in the game. I'm gonna use all these stats to pump my vitality to like a billion. I can just barely hold up the shield and tank this combo. Like, they so carefully balanced it to be just barely possible. Yeah, I love Elden Ring. I can't get enough of it. And the worst part is that after beating the DLC, I went back to the main game, installed like a fan community mod that's like a combat rebalance, played another 20 hours, and was just like, okay, dude, you are wringing the stone dry. There's
you are becoming that yet. Guy who just plays Dark Souls all the time.
Yeah, I was like, okay, like, this doesn't really change things enough. You're in the boring, you've played the first area like 5 times now. Move on to something else, please. But it was just like, there is nothing more in that moment. I wanted to do more than play more Elden Ring because I like the DLC that much.
Yeah, that's
yeah.
That's as big of a flag that anybody can fly for a DLC's game of the year. I think, like, when you literally say the most fun I've ever had with a video game, yeah. I don't know how you, like, argue that.
Because I really like exploring 3D worlds.
Yeah.
And this one having, like, there's one part where there's, like, you know, the typical, like, hidden wall. You whack the wall, yeah, and there's a door and you go down.
The fantasy wall.
There's, like, a single breakable wall led to like a 3-evening journey down a ravine.
Incredible.
Where it's like, it opens up into this big lake, and then there's a canyon down there. Then there's a catacomb, and then you take an elevator down and you're in hell.
Oh my God.
And then there's a mansion at the end of that. And then at the end of that is one of the major bosses, is all behind a single breaking wall. I'm like, you have to be fucking kidding me with this game. And I had to play offline, so there wasn't like a million messages in front of it saying, hit here. I noticed the faintest outline there, and I go, oh, that's probably a hidden wall, and it was. But I did not expect there to be like 10 hours of content behind it.
Christ.
From Software are legitimately insane.
They're insane. And then it's insane how big this is, and then they immediately announce another Elden Ring project this year.
You got any interest in the new Armored Core?
I mean, maybe.
It looks really good.
It does. Like, that's something I want to play.
You want to get into Armored Core?
Yeah.
Cool. That's awesome. Yeah, that's awesome. Like, it looks so good.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people do a lot of hand-wringing about, oh, you can't have a DLC's game of the year. Like, dude. Like, and it's just like, I'm so glad.
That truly never crashed my mind. I was like, this is obviously.
God, that is literally all I saw for, like, the last 2 weeks on my fucking timeline, is people whining about, like, the Game Awards having Shadow of the Erdtree as a game of the year contender. And it's just like, look, if my best friend tells me best time I ever had playing a video game, sorry, Shadow of the Erdtree is game of the year worthy.
It is a weird case, because to get to it you have to play like 80 hours of Elden Ring.
Like, it is such super Elden late Ring game. DLC, I know. You it's like Elden Ring. Every
Trails game after the first one.
There you go.
It's funny because Elden Ring is the game of like extreme excess, where a lot of people were like, had too much of it by the end.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then there's this for weirdos like me who still wanted more.
Fantastic. I wonder, like, if since I've been away from Souls for like 5 years, if maybe Elden Ring might actually hit.
I mean, I compared to there is Bloodborne. It's this or Bloodborne.
This or Bloodborne, right? Like, it has to be Bloodborne. And I kind of feel like Bloodborne is more like the Poly thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I'm not willing to slam it down like the big open world game that is way too big is the Poly one.
Nah,
no, that's probably not true.
You're probably right on that. Yeah. you're real for recognizing that.
But I'm like, it's definitely not Dark Souls 3. That's one's forgettable. Good,
Dark Souls 3 just kind of bored me to tears.
Okay, I think it's time.
That's game of the year for Rhett. John, close us out. You started us with a banger like 27 hours ago when we started recording. Here we are. We're all old, disheveled, and we just want to fucking go home. What you got, John?
So you put me last, so I get to be the, oh God, stop talking.
I normally do. I just wanted to mix things up this way. It wasn't a slight. I normally do Polly last.
It's not a problem. So this is the year of anthology games. This is the year of UFO 50, 80s Namco arcade games, Anthology of a Killer, Live Alive. What if I told you that there is one collection of games that I played before any of those that I played starting in December of last year? And in my heart, I was like, this collective is my game of the year. And I held on to that for the whole year.
Wow.
In part because I believe it in my heart that this is my number one, and in part because it's very funny. My number one is Kaizo Super Mario World ROM Hacks.
Yeah, I knew it.
I almost spoiled this earlier when Kaizo came up. I'm like, oh shit, is that it?
This is where my brain has been on the top of John's list the whole time. This is where I've been. I had you pegged in
John.
You know, like, look, there's Soxcast lore that people don't know about.
Wait, what'd you say there, Rats?
I said you pegged John.
That was Polly's joke. Okay, good. Buy me dinner first. So this has been my journey. Some years ago, while recovering from a breakup, I played Kaizo Mario World, the original, for like 2 straight weeks. I save state practiced it. I got really good at it. I got to a point where I could play through every individual checkpoint successfully without any further save points. So you get to a checkpoint and then play through it. The problem is Kaizo Mario World has lives.
Yeah.
So you can save after every single level except for Switch Palaces.
Yeah.
So the goal, and you can play as on 2-player mode and then get to play as both Mario and Luigi. And if any one of them gets, so you have 10 lives to make it through a given level or 2 levels if you have to do a Switch Palace first. I could beat every checkpoint. I couldn't beat it in 10 lives each. It's just too fucking hard.
Yeah.
So earlier in fall last year, I booted up Memory Lane. It's a ROM hack that's styled to be like classic Kaizo hacks, like Kaizo Mario World, but it has a bunch of modern conveniences. You instantly restart at a checkpoint and you have infinite lives. Mm. And I just saw it on YouTube one day. I was like, oh, that looks pretty. I've been watching Kaizo Mario World hacks for years on GDQ.
Yeah. The Grand Pooh Bear has been just killing it at, like, in a live setting to play those. That's nuts.
Mm-hmm. I think the first one I watched that blew open my whole brain was Invictus.
Yep.
Where it's this chocolate hack that's full of like a custom assembly to do like cool level gimmicks.
Lots of cool shit.
Amazing aesthetics and tunes. It's incredible. So I played Memory Lane. I played for 5 hours and couldn't beat the first level.
God damn.
And I was like, fucker. Why can't I do this? I just want to.
Why am I so stupid?
I want to be part of your world. I want to be like you. And so then I kind of pulled back and was like, okay. And I Googled Kaizo beginner hacks. And it turns out there's a whole world of those. There's a whole world of YouTubers who say, here's a step-by-step path of escalating difficulty hacks for you to get into Kaizo hacks.
That's so like not what I would have expected either.
No, they love onboarding people.
That's so cool.
There's tons of beginner hacks. There are tons of gorgeous beginner hacks. The first one I played was Of Jumps and Platforms, which isn't a Kaizo hack. It's just like a difficult platforming hack. It's just like seven amazing levels. It's just seven levels that are more fun than anything in Vanilla Super Mario World by a mile. And I was just like, oh shit. The first Kaizo hack I cleared was Love Yourself, which is still maybe my favorite. Like if you have to peg one as like a game for my number one, I really liked Love Yourself. It's the same one that Cecile listed. Mm-hmm. It's very comfy. It's very much a beginner hack. And then also it does a really cool thing with the storytelling and the finale that I fucking loved. And again, it's just cooler than anything you get in a vanilla Mario game.
Yeah.
Most of these aren't like, don't have like that kind of storytelling gumption, but they all they pretty much all like have a very fine tuned sense of aesthetics. And the mature Kaizo hacks of today, of like the last like 3 or 4 years, they feel so tight. They feel so good because there's infinite restarts. They deliberately slide away from frame perfect tricks. They like to give you like at least like a 3 or 4 frame window. So it's still really tight,
yeah,
but you can reasonably learn it, and kind of execute consistently. What I started doing was like timing how long it took me to beat levels. Mm-hmm. And I had like this whole spreadsheet that was like escalating Kaizo hack difficulty. I started with Love Yourself. I got to Quickie World, which had one level that took me 2 hours. I was like, that's about as hard as it ever gets. That's about as hard as it ever got. It was this one level in Quickie World, this climactic level, and I beat it, and I felt like a fucking god. I played 2 Kaizo 2 Learn, which is like 70 micro levels that are all tuned around teaching you specific Kaizo concepts.
Oh, that's a good, like that is such a good thing, because there are so many tricks and things that you see in all the various mm-hmm. Kaizo hacks that are like it's all a similar language. You see these things repeated over and over.
Exactly. But then they tune them in different ways. There's the way they have different aesthetics, like the way that they remix these same verbs over and over. It's astounding. It's so pretty. The only thing I can think of that's felt similar to me are like Doomwad scenes. And I haven't really penetrated those to the same extent.
Yeah.
And guess what I finally, oh, so all those hacks were labeled Kaizo Beginner on SMW Central. And then I went back to Memory Lane, my first Kaizo Intermediate hack.
Oh,
and
baby.
And after 7.5 hours, I successfully cleared its 7 levels. It felt so fucking
there
good.
You go. There's nothing can give you that feeling than just having worked up to it.
Mm-hmm. The very last one I cleared was Gamble earlier in the year. I haven't gotten back to them yet. My end goal, 2 end goals. I want to clear the original Kaizo Mario World sure. legit.
Yeah.
I can definitely do it. Yeah. It's a Kaizo expert hack though, which is really scary. And I want to clear Invictus because that is the upper end of Kaizo Intermediate.
That's so insane, though.
It's but again, I Memory Lane was impossible. So I spent hours on the first level and didn't beat it. And then I went back to it after doing all this onboarding, and then I cleared it without much trouble. I look at Invictus now on YouTube footage, and I'm like, oh yeah, I can do that. I know those tricks now. I know this language. Mm-hmm. So I hope to have another big Kaizo Mario binge. I really want to clear Invictus because that's like the big epic one. That's there's insane hacks like the Grand Poo World 3 and whatnot that I don't really care that much about. I don't need that. There's ones that have big epic post game meta puzzles.
Oh my God.
That's both Grand Poo World 2 and 3.
Yep.
In order to unlock the true final boss, you have to like piece together all of these puzzles and bits of text that are like on the level geometry across the game.
Yeah.
What the heck?
So the ones I'm playing are like linear romps where you just do the hard levels in a row. It's
like
so
a good
fun.
Romp.
Yeah. I want to, one that's too hard for me, probably forever, but I want to single out anyway is Supersonic Saves the World. This is a Matty Thorson hack. Mm. It's huge. It's insanely huge. I think she made it with some friends during the pandemic and just like completely went nuts on it. It finally got an abridged version was shown at GDQ recently, but like it's outrageously funny. I recommend just because none of us are going to be good enough to beat it. I just recommend watching I completely zonked on his name. Damn it, I completely zonked on his name. Fuck, it's the guy that's that. Oh, Grand Pooh Bear, duh.
He did a whole
stream series where he played all of Supersonic Saves the World, and it's very well done.
Isn't Dan Salvato like a Kaizo dude too?
He's a Kaizo guy. Absolutely, he's a Kaizo guy.
I love that his last appearance at a major event, he's like, "Hi, I'm Dan Salvato. I'm mostly known for Super Mario World hacks." Oh, he's got a good sense of humor. I love it.
Aren't you Dan Salvato, the creator of Doki Doki Panic? There's another intro to Mario. He's in a lot of Mario things. So there's also a whole Let's Play, it looks like, that Maddie made of it. This was originally not released. It was shown, like, it was, like, shared around privately.
Yeah.
It's that and
that hidden Kaizo shit. That underground.
So this is also the secret half of my number one pick, which is that after this entire Kaizo binge, I loaded up a fresh file in Celeste.
Yeah,
this is my number one. I would have given this to SMW anyway, but I feel that I just went so deep on Celeste. I played Celeste for 30 hours. I'd only played the main game before. I beat the whole main game. I got all the strobs. That's nothing. Then the game starts.
Then you have, yeah, the real yeah. Celeste starts here.
The true Celeste starts here. I played the B-sides as I went, and then I cleared all the C-sides.
Then the C-sides. I think C7 Toad's is doing the same thing. Like, I think Toad recently was talking about doing this too.
Yeah, it's really good. And then I cleared Farewell.
There you go.
It fucking ruled. Farewell's easier than
C7. C7. Yeah.
Most of the C-sides aren't hard. The hardest one is C7. That one took me 2 hours, which is, again, 2 hours is the upper limit of...
of a Kaizo level.
Of any time I've taken on any Kaizo level. It's like there were like three levels across all these games and hacks that took me 2 hours, and C7 was one of them.
C7 is where I tapped out.
It's really satisfying to get it down.
That last string, though, is a lot.
It's really good, Rhett. So I've gone my whole life not really liking Massacre games. Sure. Like, straight... I like arcade platformers with lives where you string together a 20-minute game in one go.
Yeah.
These are insanely hard individual checkpoints that you grind for hours and hours and hours. That you grind until you clear them. And I didn't like that. It just didn't. I think what I've learned from Kaizo hacks that let me appreciate Celeste was just that you can build a dramatic arc in play through the grind of like beating these individually hard checkpoints instead of trying to string together a complete run. And that's I feel like I unlocked a whole genre for me just by playing these Kaizo hacks. I fucking love Celeste. It's really good.
Yeah, Celeste is just fucking great.
Yep. I love that Maddie made Jumper 20 years ago, and then Mike dropped the genre later on and is really plugged into Kaizo. Yeah, Kaizo hacks.
That's
awesome.
Just such a solid through line.
So that's my... I love platformers.
Who doesn't?
Love good platformers.
We all do.
So that's my number one.
Nice.
We also all love the fact that we have reached the end of this very long journey and we can all stop talking. Just a couple of more minutes. There's a little
more. It took 7.5 hours.
There's just a little we need from everybody else. We need to do one final recap and then we'll get the hell out of here. So from 10 to 1, my final list is number 10, UFO 50. Number 9, Hypnospace Outlaw. Number 8, Patrick's Parabox. Number 7, Persona 3 Reload and Yukari's Gorgeous Body. Number 6 is Kubinashi Recollection. Number 5, Seabed. Number 4, Gal Guardians Demon Purge. Number 3, Mary Skelter Finale. Number 2, 1000 Times Resist. And my game of the year is the Flowers Visual Novel Quadrilogy. Rhett!
Number 12, Death's Gambit Afterlife. Number 11, Animal Well. Number 10, Hi-Fi Rush. Number 9, Gal Guardians Demon Purge. Number 8, Grand Blue Fantasy Relink. Number 7, Uta Wa Rerumumumu. I thought I had it and then I didn't. Prelude to the Fallen.
You were so close.
You'll be a real fan once you can say it.
Number 6, Tunic. Number 5, The Legend of Nyuta, Boundless Trails. Number 4, Aquarium. Number 3, Outer Wilds. Number 2, UFO 50. Number 1, Elden Ring, Shadow of the Erdtree.
John!
Incredible. Number 10, Sylvie RPG. 7, Elf Apocalypse. Number 9, Tales of Phantasia. Number 8, UFO 50. Number 7, Esk Galuda. Number 6, 80s Namco Arcade Games. Number 5, Pokemon Mystery Dungeon, Explorers of Sky. Number 4, Anthology of the Killer. Number 3, Seabed. Number 2, Live Alive. Number 1, Super Mario World ROM Hacks plus Celeste.
The most games.
The most the, video games. I of course, want to close things out by thanking everybody who took time to send us their list. They're always the most important. I always look forward to what the community has. I obviously am always super excited to find out what these two goobers are going to pick. But it's always the weird stuff in the community that you start finding that bubbles to the top that's always going to be something that I kind of like, oh, man, I think I want to go dig in to that. But thank you, everybody, for the vibes. Thank you for filling out your lists. Thank you for giving us some of your time. And if you're listening right now, then man, you're insane. I appreciate it though. Like we all do. And we will all still hopefully.
I got one more thing.
Yeah.
The number one with 6 picks between us and listener lists was UFO 50.
Of course.
The number 2 was Balatro with 4. Uh-huh. And then tied for the 3rd slot was Anthology with 3 votes was Anthology the Killer, Seabed, Like a Dragon, Infinite Wealth, and Ease 10.
Wow. You couldn't also, ask
we got
for
7 elf mentions that I noticed.
7 elf mentions. Nice. We all want a fucking elf unprotected.
Yep.
All right, John, where can the internet people, folks at home, find you?
Farawaytimes.itch.io or farawaytimes.com. I have a website again.
Nice. Look at you. You even got a com, so you're just real professional.
Yeah. I mean, I've had that for 10 years. I finally put it to use again.
Where's the internet finding you?
If you want to be 100% honest, x.com/RhettForHololivePorn.
There you go. Get all the Hololive porn you could ever want on Twitch because Rhett's going to be posting it all. You could find me at Poly Plushie pretty much everywhere. I'm mostly on Blue Sky these days. And you can also find me at socksmakepeoplesexy.itch.io. That rounds us out. We will catch you folks again next year. Thank you again for contributing, and thank you for listening. And remember, we are the podcast that loves you. We are the only ones that love you.